shooting star from the crowd. In case you can't speak Spanish, the fans were screaming, "Holy shit," over and over again.
And how would you say that in Spanish?
Holy shit.
Did you hear the discussion about the length of your penis? Did you hear
that? Yeah, I heard a lot of it. I don't know if I heard the whole thing because I couldn't understand everything, but I did hear numbers talked. I heard two-thirds, and I compared it to hands and feet and figured it out. I heard that part.
Do you have any doubt, as you sit in that witness stand today, that you were discussing the length of your penis on Bubba's radio program? Any doubt?
Well, it's not mine, because mine isn't that size, but we were discussing the length of Hulk Hogan's.
Seriously? So you
no, seriously, I do not have a 10-inch penis. No, I do not. Okay. Seriously.
Fair enough. So what you're telling us is you were discussing
Hulk Hogan's penis,
right?
Excuse me?
You were discussing Hulk Hogan's penis.
Yeah, because Terry Bollea's penis is not 10 inches like you're trying to say. I got something deep inside of a 10-inch penis.
It's business time, baby.
The Solomonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat! You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 430 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, March 13th, 2016. I am the Solomonster. I went to go see 10 Cloverfield Lane in IMAX on Friday night. I won't spoil anything for you other than to say John Goodman owns this movie. He was fantastic. Would have been better if Roseanne showed up as the monster in the end. I do want to talk about the movie, though, so what I'll do is at the very end of the podcast, I'll put a spoiler warning out there first before I say anything, and then I'll give you my thoughts about the movie for those people, because some people have asked me, what'd you think, should I go see it? So I'll hold that off until the end of the show. I'll give a spoiler warning before, and then we'll talk about it. I mean, you guys know how amped up I was when the first Cloverfield came out 8 years ago. I talked about it here on the podcast, so we'll definitely get into that a little bit later. Also, remember what I mentioned at the top of the podcast last week. I said mark it down. Sunday, April 2nd, 2017. That was the rumored date for WrestleMania 33 from the Citrus Bowl in Orlando, the site of WrestleMania 24. And the very next day, they made it official. WrestleMania is coming back to the Citrus Bowl on April 2nd next year, and they'll have all the usual events, the Hall of Fame and Fan Access, NXT, and they had a big press conference. John Cena was there. He made it official. He confirmed he will not be back in time for WrestleMania 32. Roman Reigns, the supposedly injured Roman Reigns, was there, suit and tie, looking all dapper, looking like nothing was wrong. I guess it was very important for them to have him there since he's the new face and all. So it is official, so you can start making your plans for next year. The interesting part of this, and this was something that was reported in one of the trade publications in that industry. It's like an amusement trade publication about Universal Studios in Orlando possibly opening up a museum-restaurant hybrid for WWE at Universal Studios, replacing NBA City. It's been a rumor for a while. This is nothing new. That they might be bringing an attraction over there. And it's still not confirmed. I mean, WWE hasn't said a word about it. They certainly didn't say anything about it at the press conference. But based on what this publication said, it is moving forward, and it's expected to be opened by March of next year, just in time for WrestleMania, which would make sense. So the museum part is interesting. The belief is that that may be their physical Hall of Fame. They'll have memorabilia there. And a restaurant similar, I guess, to what WWF New York was in Times Square. I went there a few times when WWF New York was open. I know they lost a shit ton of money on that. They lost like $30 or $40 million before they shut that thing down. It's Times Square. I mean, you're not going to pay higher rent anywhere in the world than you probably would in Times Square. So in that regard, it was probably the worst place for it. But yeah, I remember it being pretty fun. You walk in, the first thing you see, you walk into the merchandise store. They have wrestling theme music playing over the loudspeaker. You go downstairs, that's where the actual restaurant nightclub portion was. They had a stage, so whenever they would have music or anything, they would be on stage. Yeah, the food there was pretty good from what I remember. I had a good burger there. It's the same, you know, overpriced food you'll find all over Times Square. Anybody who's been to Times Square, you know what I'm talking about. It's not bad, but it's probably not worth the price they charge. But Universal's a tourist destination. They have the relationship there in Orlando. They got that's practically their home base now. I mean, aside from Stanford, they've got the Performance Center, Full Sail, you know, the NXT connection. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm pretty amped up for something like that. They have like a WWE World. I don't mean that was the name of the restaurant in New York. I mean like an actual area. You know, when I went to Universal for the Rumble in January, I hadn't been to Universal Studios since I was in my teens. So I didn't really have too many memories of it. And you go there, and they have these different areas. They're like their own little world. So I think of The Simpsons. We went to go to The Simpsons World. And it's the coolest thing. And I'm not even a huge Simpsons fan. I don't watch the show or anything like that. But you feel like you're in Springfield. You know, it's done up like you're on a street in Springfield, and there's Moe's Tavern, and it's just, it's cool. So I think if they did something similar like that for WWE, maybe, you know, make it look like an arena, and they have, you know, there's the restaurant, and maybe they have some other stuff. I don't know, I think it could be kind of cool. Speaking of WrestleMania, one more thing. I wanted to mention this before I forget. Ryan, in our Facebook group, brought up the fact that WWE is giving away WrestleMania on the network for free this year. And he just didn't understand why so many people online were upset about this. Well, first of all, it's the internet. That's number one. So you're always going to have people upset about something. And as Ryan said, you know, it's all about new subscribers. And he's right. I mean, it is. But I said this in the post that he made in the group. I think the issue that people have with it is that unlike before, where they would offer a free trial and it would expire with WrestleMania, like right before WrestleMania, typically, I think it would expire. Or maybe the next day. So they would say, well, the night after WrestleMania, after Raw, we're going to have a new Stone Cold podcast with a big guest. You know, let's say it was Stone Cold interviewing The Undertaker, right? A lot of people would probably want to see that, and they would be willing to sign up for the network if they were forced to do so and forced to pay for it. So maybe it would, you know, start the next day, like after WrestleMania. And that would make sense. Here, they're giving away everything for free. They're promoting the fact that you can get Roadblock last night, which we're going to talk about in a second, NXT TakeOver, the Hall of Fame, and WrestleMania, all for free. And then in theory, on April 4, you could cancel and not pay a dime. That's different. That's very different than what they were doing before. So, you know, it's a risk. They apparently have a fairly high retention rate on these free months. That's why they keep doing them. However many people they lose, they keep a good portion of them. And so they're looking longer term at the health of the network. The network and the success of the network is very important to them going forward. Their goal is to boost those subscribers. That's all they're interested in. They want to drive that subscriber number up so that each quarter, as the years go on, they don't go backwards. They keep trending up, up, up. That's what they want. Now, if it were me, I would have offered Roadblock and maybe TakeOver for free, because you know those are going to be two good shows. I thought Roadblock overall was a good show, and I think TakeOver is going to be a freaking phenomenal show. There's no reason for it not to be. So you give people those shows for free, but you make them pay for WrestleMania. I just think once you start giving away your biggest show of the year for free, I think it sets a bad precedent, because why would they pay for it in the future? It's like they took everything off pay-per-view, right? I mean, technically you could still buy it on pay-per-view, but they're trying to... I mean, they literally hold signs up on Raw that say, hey, dummy, why would you pay $55 for pay-per-view when you can pay $9.99 for the network? They're basically calling you a dumb shit if you keep ordering the pay-per-views. They don't want you to do that. So they've cannibalized their pay-per-view business because they're banking everything on this network. Now, imagine one day, let's say the network fails, right? I don't want to see it fail. I like the network. But let's say it doesn't work out. They have to go back now to the way things were before. And they're putting everything back on pay-per-view, and they're pushing the pay-per-view. Okay, we want you to pay $45 or $55 in HD for Battleground, or for No Mercy, or Armageddon, whatever their pay-per-views. I don't even know what half their freaking shows are called anymore. But we want you to pay full price now for those shows, plus the Rumble and SummerSlam and everything else. You think you're going to have all those people that were paying full price before you? And by the way, those pay-per-view numbers as it was were coming down. which is probably one of the reasons why it was so easy for them to say, hey, we're going to abandon pay-per-view and shift over to this new model. You look at UFC, UFC is doing gangbuster business. I mean, in the last few months, they've had pay-per-views, they've had multiple pay-per-views that have done over a million buys. WWE has never done that ever. You know, WrestleMania sometimes would top a million, but they've never had, you know, back-to-back shows or multiple shows in a year that did that kind of business. So it's not a situation where pay-per-view is dead, although they may want you to believe that. WWE's pay-per-view business was kind of dying a slow death, and so they made what they felt was the right move. But all of a sudden, if they had to go back to doing that one day for whatever reason, you know, it's going to bite them on the ass. You're telling people for so long, hey, dummy, why pay full price for these things when you can just pay $9.99? So you start offering WrestleMania for free. You know, maybe they'll just do it once. You know what? Once sometimes is all that it takes. I just think that's the one show I would not fuck around with. That's the one show I would not tell people, hey, you don't have to pay anything for it. Just sign up. You'll get it for free. Once you start giving things away for free, people, you know, they're not going to want to pay for it. So that would be my concern. But I understand why they're doing it. I understand their rationale for doing it. It's a risk. You know, hopefully for their sake, it pays off. Let me just say that Audible is still offering listeners of this podcast a 30-day trial of its audiobook service. You can use our URL, which is audibletrial.com/solomonster. You're really helping the podcast out when you punch that in and sign up. It's not enough to just put the link in. You got to go. You've got to sign up. You get to sample the service free for a month. Okay, you got 30 days. You can choose from over 180,000 different audiobook titles. They don't have to be wrestling-related, but there are tons of wrestling books on there. A lot of good ones, too. I've read Brock Lesnar's book, Chris Jericho's third book. Both of those were really good. Jericho's especially. I think he's done some of the best wrestling books out of anybody. Daniel Bryan's book, which I still have not gotten to, but I hope to soon. That's up there. Hogan. Hogan. Oh, Hogan. We're going to talk about him in a second, too. But anyway, if you want to support this podcast, one of the easiest things you could do is go to audibletrial.com/solomonster, sign up, check it out. If you don't like it, if you think in those 30 days, you know what, this is just not for me, that's cool. You can cancel, you won't be billed, and the cool thing about it is you get to keep your audiobook, because you get one free audiobook when you sign up, you get to keep it. Belongs to you, you don't have to give it back. So again, audibletrial.com/solomonster. If you are one of the people that have already used the link, feel free to pass it around. You know, if you have a friend or a family member, a parent, grandparent who you think might be able to get some use out of it, and they like reading, and maybe, you know, an audiobook title might be something they've never tried before but they may enjoy, by all means, you know, pass the link around. The more the merrier. We also have two new shirts up in our Pro Wrestling Tees store, prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff, both 1992 themed. We've got close to two dozen. If not two dozen shirts now up in the store. Tons to choose from. And so get on that if you don't have a Sound Off shirt. You can represent the podcast whenever you're out and about. If you got any wrestling shows, Pro Wrestling Tees is the place to go for that. They do ship all over the world. They ship up to a size 5XL. And for those who have asked about the soft cotton versus non-soft cotton, you know, the couple of shirts that I've gotten from there before, actually more than a couple, I usually do the soft cotton, but it's a matter of personal preference. I do like it more. You pay, you know, an extra $1 or $2 for it, I think. But the quality, regardless, is very good. I think you'll enjoy it. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so at any time on thesolomonster.com. Still the most direct way to show your support. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. I want to say thank you to Russell the Muscle, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, the Seattle Saint Marco Wallace, Payback Tejas Bagwat, Thomas the Promise Murphy, the Human Torch Troy Smith, True Grit Tim Goggin, the Chosen Son Andre Smith, the Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Jordan the Joke Man Chuck Raverty, and the Emperor Abdul Rahman Tobin. Thank you guys very, very much for making a donation, which again, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. Now, I've been following this Hulk Hogan Gawker trial. I'm sure many of you have as well. I mean, how can you not? This is a podcaster's dream. It is the gift that keeps on giving. I hope this trial never ends. And, you know, I've actually mentioned here how I'm now serving on a grand jury for the next 4 months. I got picked and I started a couple of weeks ago. At least 4 months. It could go longer than that, but at the minimum, I'm serving for 4 months. This would have been a fun trial to get. Scary in some ways, but I think fun. Although I guess I would have been excused as a potential juror if they ever found out I do a wrestling podcast. I guess that would kind of be a conflict of interest. But I do hope Hogan wins. I hope he wins because I think what happened to him was really shitty. And I think Gawker sucks. And one of my favorite parts of the trial so far was Hogan on the witness stand, which has just been gold. I didn't know he was actually going to get up and testify. So he's been on the witness stand, and this is how he described the Hulk Hogan character. Okay, and I'm quoting here. He's on the stand, he's under oath, and he describes the Hogan character as just the all-American good guy fighting for the rights of every man. He was quoting Rick Derringer lyrics in court while wearing a bandana. This guy's amazing. Then, of course, you heard at the top of the podcast the now infamous line where he says, I do not have a 10-inch penis. Terry Bollea's penis is not 10 inches. He made that very clear. Hulk Hogan's penis is 10 inches, but not Terry Bollea. Of course, it's impossible to distinguish between the two because they're basically one and the same. And on top of that, Hulk's former BFF, Brutus the Barber Beefcake, has jumped in here. He's very, very mad at Hulk Hogan because in part of his testimony this week, Hogan talked about how he has almost no friends anymore. And he used to be friends with Beefcake, but he and Beefcake's new wife, I don't know her name, but they don't get along. So therefore, he and Beefcake, maybe there was a falling out, something happened, and so they're not friends anymore. Beefcake then went on Facebook to defend his wife, because he was very upset that his wife's name would even be invoked in this trial. And he told Hogan to tell the truth about why their friendship ended, which is like asking TNA to pay its talent on time. I mean, you can ask, but you know it's never going to happen. So if Beefcake wants to defend his wife, if his wife's name was mentioned in the course of all this tawdry, slimy, gutter garbage, you know, I get it, okay? That's cool and all. But I think it's rich, you know, Beefcake being all pissed off and upset at Hogan. You know, if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, nobody would even know this guy's name. And you can pick whichever one you want because he's had about 5 million of them. Okay, you could the Beefcake, Butcher, Zodiac, Booty Man, the Disciple. I'm sure there's a couple of others I'm forgetting. Now he's angry with Hogan. All of a sudden, Hulk Hogan, he's very upset with him. Unless Hogan fucked around with his wife also, which wouldn't be the first time that he's fucked around with another guy's wife. I don't really see what he has to complain about here. Brutus Beefcake is the last person who should be bitching and moaning about Hulk Hogan, because without Hulk Hogan, there is no Brutus Beefcake. You talk about friends with benefits. Nobody has benefited more from being friends with Hulk Hogan in the wrestling business than Brutus Beefcake has. Let's talk about this Roadblock show from last night in Toronto. You guys voted on Twitter the main event of Triple H against Dean Ambrose as the match of the night. 49% of the vote. Second place was the NXT Tag Team title match at 31%, Charlotte against Natalya at 15%, and Brock Lesnar against Luke Harper came in at just 5%. Yes, Luke Harper, not Bray Wyatt. He was out there with Harper, and I think they may have said it was a two-on-one handicap match. I turned the commentary down low after a while, I'm not going to lie, because I couldn't stand listening to them anymore. So it's very possible that they said certain things that I didn't pick up on. But Bray was out there, but it was basically just a singles match. He never got into the ring once the bell rang, even though it was advertised originally as Brock Lesnar. Well, originally it was advertised, to be fair, as Brock Lesnar against Luke Harper. That was the original advertising up until a few weeks ago. And then they changed it. And on television, they promoted it as Brock against Bray, which was originally going to be the WrestleMania match before Vince changed his mind, which I think was for the better. I think that's a better WrestleMania match anyway. But all I could think here is, you know, maybe they just realized maybe we shouldn't be beating this guy again, right? I talked about that last week. The problem here is that the Wyatt family and Bray Wyatt, they don't win anymore. And so putting him in there against Brock Lesnar, there was really only one outcome that you could do, which was Brock Lesnar wins, even if it's by DQ, and the rest of the family were to run in. You're not going to beat Brock Lesnar on a network special 2 or 3 weeks before WrestleMania. It's just, it's stupidity. You're not going to do that. He got dumped out of the Royal Rumble. He didn't get pinned, but he got beat in the triple threat. He came out on the losing end of that at Fastlane. Now you're going to beat Brock again? So the only outcome was for Bray to lose. Maybe they realized that and they said, you know what, this might be a little too much. Maybe we shouldn't beat this guy. And also, let's just throw Luke Harper to the wolves because he loses all the time anyway, so who the hell cares? You know, either that or they want to save the match for SummerSlam, because I do believe, there's no doubt in my mind, we're going to get Brock Lesnar against Bray Wyatt this year at some point. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So maybe they said, you know what, let's save their first match for another time and not beat him here. And really what was just, it was just a house show. And so that kind of goes to the heart of what I thought about Roadblock. And there were some complaints. I was kind of looking at the Twitter feedback. Yeah, I made some positive comments about the show, and there were not too many. There were some people who said, are you crazy? The show was boring. It sucked. It didn't suck. I thought Roadblock was a good, straightforward wrestling show. It was a glorified house show. That's what, when I said glorified, it was a house show with TV cameras and commentary. And frankly, it would have been better without commentary. The show would have been much better last night if they would have just had the action and no commentary. It's not like that those guys offered anything. It's not like the Three Stooges were out there telling us stuff we didn't already know. So, but that's what it was. It was a glorified house show. They even used the house show stage, which I liked. It was different. It was different from what we see every week on TV. It actually, again, it wasn't really creative. Like I said, it was just the house show stage, but it almost looked like a little bit more creativity was put into it than they do for any of their actual pay-per-views, because the actual pay-per-views, it's just the usual set. And I understand why they do that. They spent millions of dollars on that stage and that set with all the LED lights and everything else, so they want to get their money's worth out of it. And it costs money. It does cost money for custom sets, but I still think for some, maybe not every pay-per-view, but when you do a Royal Rumble or you do a SummerSlam, and maybe even if you do like an NXT TakeOver show, it doesn't even have to be as fancy, you should put a little bit of effort into trying something different, because there's just a sameness to all these shows that now they have a network special using the freaking house show stage, and it's like, oh, it's different, it's great. So, I mean, if that doesn't send a message to you, then I don't know what will. So I liked it. There were no surprises on this show. I didn't expect any. It was really no different than what you would see on TV any given week, except they had a championship match in the main event. You don't see too many of those on TV for the WWE title anymore. And as far as that goes, you know, I told you they weren't taking that title off Triple H before Roman got a shot at it, and they didn't. I know there were people hoping against hope. They're going to shake things up. They're going to give Dean Ambrose his just due. It was never going to happen. It was never going to happen. The main event was predictable but enjoyable. It was a really good match. I'm also going to predict, I know I'm going out on a limb here, but going to predict that that was probably the last successful title defense of any kind that we ever see from Triple H in his career. I think we just saw it last night. At least I hope so. We had New Day opening against Sheamus and King Barrett of the League of Nations for the tag team titles. Yeah, pretty pedestrian stuff. It was fine. Barrett had Big E pinned. Xavier had the referee distracted, and that was enough to distract Barrett, who then ate a big ending for the pin. Chris Jericho came out. He insulted all of Canada by talking about how ashamed he was to be a Canadian. He said Canada literally stinks and Toronto is the anus. That'll make a great PayPal nickname for one of you guys someday. The anus. And it's funny too, because on the Edge and Christian show that aired after this, it was last week's episode, there were mentions of hand jobs, lube, and ass cream, although the ass cream mentioned, I think, was the preview for this week's show. So we went from talking about the anus to then talking about handjobs, lube, and ass cream. That's what you would have referred to back in the day as a typical week in the Attitude Era. Jericho then beat Jack Swagger with the Walls of Jericho. The Revival, which is the name they're using for Dash and Dawson, which is weird, but that's the name they chose, against Colin Cassidy and Enzo Amore for the NXT Tag Team titles. This was fun. Crowd was hot for Kaz and Enzo. They knew all their catchphrases and everything. They looked like they would belong on the main roster tomorrow if they got called up. And I expect them to be in the next few weeks. Shatter Machine on Enzo for the clean win. This is another big reason why I expect them to be called up, because there was no reason for them to lose clean again. It just seems to me like they're doing the honors on the way out here. I mean, there's literally nothing left for these guys to do on NXT anymore. This was at least the second, I think, tag team title match they've gotten against Dash and Dawson in the last few months. I think the first one was in London. They lost clean there as well. And it was the same pattern, too, where, you know, Big Kaz is kind of taken out, and Enzo is the one who eats the Shatter Machine and gets pinned. I mean, these guys have had so many chances at the tag titles at this point. They failed every single time. There's only one thing left for them to do, and that's head down to the main roster. And I expected them to lose here for that very reason. Maybe they're saving the promotion for the night after Mania. I thought maybe they would tease something with them in New Day last night. Even after the match, you know, New Day won, Kaz and Enzo lost. Could have been as simple as a backstage segment that foreshadows something after WrestleMania, if you want to wait until then to call them up. Maybe they're backstage, they're upset, they're pissed, they're walking down the hallway, and there's New Day playing a trombone in their ear, pointing and laughing at them. It could have been something just as simple as that. And so when they come up, they have a ready-made program, you know, with the tag champs. If you know, we're assuming New Day is still the champs after Mania, which I'm not predicting they will be, but it's possible they will. But they didn't do that. They just lost clean, and there was no interaction between the two teams, and that was just how it was. But as a match, I thought this was one of the best matches on the entire show. Natalya dedicated her match with Charlotte to her uncle Brett. It's interesting how she's done that before. She very rarely talks about her actual father. You know, she's not like, I'm dedicating my match to the Anvil. She's like, no, I dedicate it to my uncle Brett. It's like, huh, okay. I wonder how Neidhart feels about that. And she convinced Charlotte to put her Divas title on the line. Charlotte was not going to put her championship on the line, and it didn't take much for her to change her mind. All Natty had to do was call her and Rick cowards. And all of a sudden, it's like, how dare you? I will give you a championship match. These heels aren't too bright. They're very thin-skinned. But it was smart to do this. You know, they were in Canada. They gave Natalya a match for the championship because they knew the hometown fans would be invested. And invested they were, especially all the near falls in this match. They really, you know, they gave them time. It was a really good match. I wouldn't put it, you know, at the same level as their match at the TakeOver show last year. I think it was last year. Which, you know, I would argue, they love talking about this Divas Revolution stuff. And, you know, if you want to think about moments where the supposed Divas Revolution began, I think back to that match. You know, I think was it May of last year or the year before? It was the TakeOver match between Charlotte and Natty, was the championship vacant at the time? It might have been. And they had Brett in one corner and Ric Flair in the other corner. And that was like a 16-minute match. It was fantastic. I would trace it back to that. Obviously, it has, you know, nothing to do with any of the Bella twins. I mean, give me a break. But so this match wasn't on that level, but this was very good. This was a very good match. And some great near fall. Charlotte, you know, hit natural selection, only got a two count. Natty got her in the sharpshooter, and I'm not sure what happened here. Flair was trying to reach in and maybe pull Charlotte to the ropes. Natty then dragged her back to the center of the ring. And then, inexplicably, she lets go of the hold. It's not like Flair jumped up on the apron. I mean, he did after, but he was still standing out on the floor. You know, he didn't throw anything at her. He didn't grab the referee by the leg. It was just she dragged her back to the middle. And you figure, okay, she's going to crank back on it now. No, she drags her to the middle and she just lets go of the hold and gets up and goes over to Ric Flair. I'm like, that was weird. She let go of the hold. So it kind of ruined the finish a little bit. I don't know if it was a botch or not, but it didn't make any sense. But it didn't ruin the match or anything. It was just a bad finish. You know, Charlotte rolled her up, got her feet on the ropes for the win, and you know, that was fine. That's, you know, a typical heel move. But that little sequence there, just something went awry, and I'm not sure what it was, but this was very good. Brock and Bray, like I mentioned before, never happened. They had Luke Harper act as his surrogate to be destroyed by Lesnar. Harper, he did get a discus clothesline in there for a near fall, but not much else. Suplex City, F5, back on the plane. It's a winning formula for Brock Lesnar. Sami Zayn, the hometown Canadian kid, had a boring match with Stardust. There were people who tweeted me they were I guess, you know, because I left that match off the best match poll that I put up on Twitter, I just assumed that some of those people were trolling, but I get the impression maybe some of them were serious that this might have been the best match on the show. I don't know what the hell they were watching, if that's what they thought, but to each their own. There was nothing special about this match. The crowd, very disappointing, especially Sammy. You know, he got a decent reaction when he came out, but, you know, he's from Canada, and you would think, oh, he's going to, you know, he's going to get this great reaction, kind of like Natalya did. And, you know, it was just kind of dead. It was just a match. It was a match that you would expect to see on Superstars or Main Event. There was just nothing special about it. I mean, it's Stardust, so... I mean, Stardust's a talented guy, but, I mean, he's Stardust. What more needs to be said? It was just a match, I guess, for Sammy to get an easy win. Which, you know, is something they should do more often. I wouldn't want Sami Zayn in his first match now officially on Raw to be wrestling, you know, fucking Chris Jericho or something, because you know he's not going to win. You know, you got to, you know, feed some opponents to these guys to make them look good. The thing with Sammy, though, is, you know, with him, he's the underdog, right? He's like the new Daniel Bryan. So he'll be the guy who sells and sells and sells for the other guy or for the bigger guy and then maybe makes a comeback in the end. But when you have a match like this that just came out of nowhere, it was a typical house show match, nobody cares, we've been given no reason to take Stardust seriously for any reason, I don't see how you can look at this as being, you know, one of the best matches on the show. I was actually kind of disappointed, but again, it was a house show match. And then we have the main event. Really good main event between Triple H and Dean Ambrose. They did a dusty finish with Ambrose hitting dirty deeds and the referee counting three, but Dean's feet were positioned underneath the bottom rope as the ref counted, so he immediately waved it off. We did get the obligatory Dean Ambrose lunatic lariat. I'm still waiting one of these days for him to do that stupid rebound off the ropes and accidentally fall out of the ring out to the floor. He mocked Triple H with some DX crotch chops outside the ring, which he would pay dearly for a few moments later. He laid Triple H out on the announce table, but Hunter moved out of the way, and Ambrose jumped off the barricade with an elbow, and he got nothing but table instead. Went right through the table. He crawled back into the ring, barely beating the 10 count, and immediately got pedigreed and pinned. Not the first, probably won't be the last. Triple H wins. They opted not to shake up their WrestleMania plans. They are staying the course with Roman Reigns. I don't know that Roman, you know, without all the bells and whistles, because I'm sure we still don't know. I mean, we're like 2 weeks out from WrestleMania. We don't have anything announced for The Rock. We don't have any role announced for Steve Austin. And you know they're both going to be there. I would imagine they know it. By this point, they must know what they're doing with these guys. We'll probably find out for at least one of them on TV this week. At least I hope that we do. We don't know what these guys are doing. So is Austin going to be a referee? Is Rock going to be in Roman's corner? I would have to think Rock's going to be involved in some way. And I only say Austin because it's WrestleMania. It's Texas. Austin should have some kind of important role on the show. I guess you can make him like a referee for the Hell in a Cell match with Undertaker and Shane. I guess that would kind of make sense, maybe. Actually, maybe not. I don't know why Vince McMahon would want Steve Austin to officiate such an important match, so scrap that. That actually would not make sense. So we'll see, but my point is, they can add all the bells and whistles to that match that they want to, and that might make the match fun and exciting, but as a match, one-on-one, Roman Reigns and Triple H... You know, I'm not sure that on his own Roman can get a better match out of Triple H that the way that Dean Ambrose did last night. I don't say that like, you know, Dean Ambrose carried Triple H. I just mean in terms of an opponent for him to go in there with and have a really, really good match. You know, we'll see. I don't know that he can get as good of a match out of Triple H as Ambrose did. I think he's got an uphill battle ahead of him, especially with that crowd in Dallas. You know, they've made their lot. They're going to go with their plan, and it's going to be ugly, right? That's what Brock Lesnar said once. It's going to be ugly, people. I can tell you that. If anything, I was kind of shocked they didn't have Brock run in to cost Ambrose the title as a way to further their story heading into WrestleMania. You know, with this whole Triple H thing, the Brock-Ambrose stuff the last couple of weeks has taken a total backseat. I mean, they've done nothing to advance that story at all. And they did nothing on this show to further any of the existing matches for WrestleMania. This was just, like I said before, a glorified house show. You look no further than what they did and did not do on this show. They didn't shoot a major angle. They didn't do a title change. They didn't do anything important to further WrestleMania. It was a show. So if you went into it expecting just a good show, I think you got what you expected. If you went in there expecting something major to happen, then you probably left disappointed. I was not disappointed. I thought it was a good show. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Chicago, Illinois. Speaking of good shows, the Instapoll took a positive turn this week. Almost 1,800 votes. 70% thumbs up. 30% thumbs down for Raw last week. There was some really good stuff on this show. I thought Kevin Owens and Neville had an awesome match. Neville busted out a Phoenix Splash from the second rope for a great near fall on Owens at one point. People were totally into this match. They were into the near falls. Owens ended up winning with a cradle. Afterwards, he went to powerbomb Neville on the apron outside. When Sami Zayn made the save to a big pop, people knew who he was. You know, he's been on Raw before. It's not like it's his first time on Raw. Plus, he was in the Royal Rumble a couple of months ago. So it's not like if you don't watch NXT, you've never seen this guy before. The announcers teased Neville getting another shot at Owens, maybe at WrestleMania, even though he lost, which he did, by the way. He got pinned. Zayn running out, I think, you know, it would lead most people to think we're going to get Sami Zayn against Kevin Owens at WrestleMania, which is what the match should be. It should be one-on-one for the Intercontinental title, Sami Zayn against Kevin Owens. And you could say, well, what has Zayn done to deserve a championship match? That's one of those little logic holes that, you know, can't really be explained. If you are an old-school fan who believes that you should actually win some matches in order to win a championship opportunity, then you're right. Sami Zayn does not deserve to walk in and get a shot at the Intercontinental title. But logic doesn't really apply to this show. And they don't really... Look, they don't have rankings. They don't have anything. I was an advocate for years. I pitched it on this show going back to Sound Off 127. And I only remember that episode number because that was the show that I did where, you know, if I were in charge of WWE, right? If Vince McMahon got hit by a bus or something and now I'm in charge, how would I run the company? What decisions would I make? So that entire episode was dedicated to that. And going as far back as that, I pitched this idea of a ranking system where at the time they had two world titles. So for the world championships, you have a top 10 ranking. And for every other title, you know, Intercontinental, Divas, IC, Tag Team, you have a top 5. And you post the updated rankings on the website every week and in the app, and people can follow along because people like that. You know, sports fans, they're big nuts when it comes to numbers and stats and following them on ESPN and fantasy football. They love that. People lap that shit up, numbers and stats. So they would follow along, and, you know, if storyline-wise something didn't fit and you wanted somebody to get a championship match, you can always do a deal where, you know, on Raw, instead of having these meaningless matches, when there's no title on the line, there's really no meaning behind them, now all of a sudden you can have a match between the number 3-ranked star and the number 6-ranked star, and, you know, if number 6 wins, he leapfrogs into the number 3 spot or something. And that way you can always shuffle people around if you want to. But at least have some kind of system. They have this Power 25 or some bullshit on their website, but it doesn't mean anything. It has no connection to the storylines on TV at all. I'm talking about something that's directly connected to what we see on TV to make it mean something. And so people can follow along. So if they had some kind of ranking system like that, you know, Sami Zayn comes in and maybe in the IC list he's at number five. Let's say he's at the bottom of the list. You know, he had a strong showing in the Rumble and he beat Stardust on this show. Let's say he's number 5. And so now he's got to have a match with, number 2 or something on Raw next week. I mean, there are at least ways then that you can explain it. Here, they don't have any kind of system. They don't really pay attention to that kind of stuff, so it doesn't matter. It makes as much sense for him to be in an IC title match at WrestleMania as anybody. Certainly more than Neville. Neville got pinned, right? Now, the thing about it is, if they have Neville in the match, because you watch this and you think, well, maybe they're setting up a triple threat. And I don't think it's going to be a triple threat. I think it's going to end up being some kind of multi-man match, unfortunately. But let's say it was going to be a three-way with Zayn, Owens, and Neville. I wouldn't be upset about that. Because you know it's going to be a freaking awesome match. Neville is an incredible performer. Neville deserves to be in some kind of a profile match at WrestleMania. I'm not going to complain if they put him in there, because that would make me a hypocrite. I would love to see him there, but on the other hand, it just feels right to do a singles match, given the past history between Zayn and Owens. Their first chance in their career to go out there. It's going to be their first WrestleMania match for both of them. And this will be the first chance for them to go out there and just tear the house down. When I predicted or advocated, whatever word you want to use, last year, like last fall, that they should do Zayn and Owens for the Intercontinental title of WrestleMania, I said they should open the show. You know, there have been some classic opening matches in WrestleMania history. You think Bret vs. Owen, you think Eddie and Ray, you think Triple H and Bryan. All of those were great matches. They set the tone, right? They're out there for 20, 25 minutes. They set the tone for the rest of the show. It's almost like, all right, now you guys go out there and top this. And also for the opening match, the crowd tends to be a little hotter. I think these two guys going out there in a real grudge match, you know, you give them 15, 20 minutes to open the show. It could be a kick-ass match. I think that would be the place for it, instead of just being in the middle of the card somewhere. Or God forbid, you know, they put them on after the Hell in a Cell match. That's the death spot. So we'll see. I just can't shake this feeling it's going to end up being a multi-man match with Miz and Ziggler and maybe a few other people in there. But if it turned out to be a triple threat, I would not be upset about that, because it's going to be a great match either way. The New Day took on Y2AJ for the tag team titles. A fantastic match, probably the best match on Raw all year. My favorite match of the week, even more than the three-way on Lucha Underground. Everything about it, from the action itself, AJ Styles looked as good here as he has since coming to WWE. He's crisp, he's quick. He outshined everybody else in this match, and everybody looked great, but he was just a step above. The action, the crowd reaction, I mean, these fans were with this thing from start to finish. Great near falls, all the way to the finishing sequence. You know, Jericho goes for the code breaker. Big E catches him in midair because he's a strong motherfucker. So he's holding Jericho up, and then he turns it. He kind of chucks him up onto his shoulders and turns it into a big ending for the pin. And then we have the post-match. So the match itself was great, but then you tack on this big angle at the end where Jericho, as I predicted last week, Jericho lays out Styles, three code breakers, takes a Y2AJ t-shirt, shoves it down his throat, Million Dollar Man style. I like the little touch of making the shirts as a way to throw people off. I mean, it didn't work on me. I said last week I'm not buying it. But I thought it was a nice touch. I think from what I read, it was like a Jericho idea, which doesn't surprise me at all that Jericho would think of something like that. And, you know, it was just a way to make people think, hey, they made t-shirts, so they must be doing this for a while. And then a week later, you know, they lower the boom. And the shots of the fans in the crowd, they found these fans that were genuinely pissed off at Jericho for what he had just done. If they would have ended the show right there with that little fade to black at the end of that segment, it would have been perfect. This would have been a fantastic show. Unfortunately, they had another hour plus to fill. And in that hour plus, we got to see Tyler Breeze jobbed out in 2 minutes, and we got an awful Ryback promo. He delivered his lines, not very well. Didn't sound like a promo any human being would say in real life, but, you know, I guess he did what he had to do. We did get another Bray Wyatt Triple H stare down. The main event was Dean Ambrose against Bray Wyatt. Triple H did come out. He was in the ring. The Wyatt family was in the ring. Bray looked at Triple H. He looked at the championship, and the crowd really liked what they saw. They liked the little tease, which was not the first time we've seen this. They teased this in the Royal Rumble match as well. There was a little something there between Bray and Triple H, and this is the second time now. So they may be foreshadowing something, potentially for down the road, maybe a babyface Bray against Triple H. Again, turning Bray babyface long-term is the right move to make, and it's the only way, I think, to save him at this point, because who the hell could take this guy seriously as a heel? I mean, really. Who could take him as a serious threat to anybody? But you lose and you lose and you lose, and then you turn babyface. Or it works both ways. I mean, you could be a babyface, and all of a sudden you're getting beaten and beaten and beaten. Look at the Dudley Boys, right? They were losing and losing and losing, but then they turned them heel. So in the end, it's okay. Like, if you know that's the direction you're headed in, you could afford to lose. The problem with the Wyatts is they've lost for so long, and they have yet to pull the trigger on a turn. So they have the stare down, they back down, they leave Triple H to his own devices to take care of Dean Ambrose, and Ambrose ended up laying out Triple H with Dirty Deeds, which, the more I say that, is actually a really terrible name for a finisher. I'm sure we can come up with something better. Why not call it, like Crazy Eyes? Right? Crazy Eye. I mean, he does, right? Ambrose does have Crazy Eyes. We should have a contest to see who can come up with a better finishing maneuver name for Dean Ambrose. And I forgot to mention Shane McMahon. Shane McMahon and his atrocious offense in that opening segment. Somehow, his punches have gotten worse since the feud with Randy Orton. I mean, you know, watching him beat up four guys was silly enough. But I understand. They have to give him some credibility if anybody is going to take him seriously in a match with The Undertaker. He's got to beat up somebody. Better to have him beat up four, you know, jabron security guards that nobody knows than beat up one of your actual talents on the roster. Although, I would not put it past them in the next couple of weeks to have Shane have a little exhibition with, like, a Tyler Breeze and beat the shit out of him on Raw. Since about, you know, that's about all he's good for to them anymore. But I get it. I get they wanted to give him some credibility. And the crowd didn't care. You know, I could talk here about how awful his punches looked and all this stuff and how ridiculous it was for him to beat up four guys all by himself. But the fact is, the crowd went nuts. They reacted big to everything that Shane did because they love him. And so it was effective. It worked. But, my God. Those fucking punches. Ah. Even John Cena's watching that going like, what the fuck, dude? He's got to work on that. He's got 2 weeks. We also learned that the Big Boss Man will be going into the WWE Hall of Fame this year. Which I was happy to hear about. You know, I think of the Boss Man. I like the Boss Man. I think of him and I think of... Well, I think of a few things. I think of the Twin Towers. When I was a kid... I was watching WWE before Boss Man even came in. But when he came in, he was part of the Twin Towers tag team. So I think of them. I think of Akeem, the African Dream. I think of his jailhouse match with the Mountie at SummerSlam. I think of being in the Nassau Coliseum the night that he came back to WWE in 98. It was actually a belated birthday gift to myself. I won tickets to Raw. I think I've mentioned before, like, when I was in high school, I would call the local radio station here, which was at the time WPLJ was the one that was giving away tickets. Every time WWE came to the Garden or they came to the Coliseum or they came to Jersey to what was the Meadowlands, they would give away free tickets. And all you had to do, you had to be caller number whatever, like 95. And so I had a system where I would call and, you know, there was a second phone line here. And so if my brother was here, I'd have him get on the other line. But it was always me. I was always the one who got through, and sometimes I'd get through and they'd be like, you know, somebody would answer really quickly and be like, you know, 71, and then they would hang up, and I would immediately call back. And I won 8 different times. I still to this day don't know how I did that. But I won 8 different times, and that was the second time I won, maybe the third. But my birthday was like a week before, so I win these tickets. I'm like, oh, I guess it's a belated birthday gift to myself. We go to the Coliseum, and that was actually, I remember that show because they had at least the finals. Maybe they had the whole thing. They had an Intercontinental title tournament that Ken Shamrock won. I think he beat X-Pac in the finals. But that was the night, the thing that I remember most, that Big Boss Man came back. All clad in black, as Vince McMahon's new bodyguard. I think that might have been the night that Austin poured cement into McMahon's Corvette. Or as Jim Ross called it, he poured cement into his Corvette. Which I would imagine would be a real bitch to get out of the upholstery. But anyway, I remember his hardcore title matches with Al Snow and making pepper steak out of his dog on SmackDown. And of course, his infamous feud with the Big Show, which produced maybe the worst WWE Championship main event on any pay-per-view. Maybe even any non-pay-per-view, but certainly on pay-per-view, that I have ever seen. 99 was quite the year for the Boss Man, now that I think about it, because within the time span of a few months that fall into the winter, he had two of the worst pay-per-view matches in WWE history. He had that Kennel from Hell match at Unforgiven with Al Snow. And then a few months later, he had his championship match at Armageddon with The Big Show. Armageddon 1999. If you don't believe me, go back on the network and watch it. You can watch Big Show lay on the floor outside the ring for about 3 out of the 5 minutes that match lasted. Actually, it may not have even gone that long. Seriously, it might have been under 5 minutes, that match. One of the worst title matches of all time. But, I can't not laugh at some of the skits they did to build up to that match. Boss Man was a vicious heel in 99. Between, you know, I mean, cooking one guy's dog and then feeding it to him. And then the stuff with the Big Show, you know, dragging his father's casket through the cemetery, breaking into Big Show's mother's house, and forcing her to call her son a bastard on live television. I mean, that feud was something else. But Boss Man is, I wouldn't say Boss Man is a Hall of Fame guy. Like, if you really think of Hall of Fame wrestlers, Boss Man is not a Hall of Fame guy. But in terms of WWE, he was a pretty big character, whether he was a heel or a babyface. I mean, as a heel, he was part of the Twin Towers, but he also had a singles run with Hulk Hogan when he was WWF champion, and they did touring. Like, they did a loop of cage matches that apparently did very good business back in, I guess it would have been 89. And I mean, he was up there in the pecking order. He was not, like, a lower card guy. And even when he turned babyface, he wasn't in main events. But he was always involved in something, whether it was the Mountie or whether it was Nails or whoever. He was always in the mix. He was always in, like, that upper mid-card mix. So as a character, heel or face, he was a big presence on that WWF roster for a good number of years. He's also a guy, you know, he had life during the, I guess what would be called the so-called Golden Era, which is the era I grew up in. And then he reinvented himself. He had another run in the Attitude Era. Not too many guys can say that they've been able to do that. They were a star in one era, left, came back, and were a star in a different era. And almost a completely different guy. I mean, he wasn't doing hardcore matches like that back in the day. So I'm happy to see him get recognized. I like the fact that he's going in. Maybe they can get Akeem to do the induction. You know, one-man gang. I think George Gray is his name. If he does, though, I want him to come out to Jive Soul Brawl. He must come out to Jive Soul Brawl doing the Akeem mannerisms. I don't know if the Akeem outfit would fit him. Probably not a good idea to wear that on stage at the Hall of Fame. Although he did say, you know, they brought him back to do that gimmick battle royal at WrestleMania 17. And I know that they wanted him to come out in the gimmick battle royal dressed as Akeem. And the thing is, I think he had had a heart attack. He lost a lot of weight. And so the Akeem outfit wouldn't fit on him. So he came out instead as the one-man gang. I saw a recent picture of him. It looks like he may put on some of that weight, you know, back on. But he doesn't have to wear the getup. He just has to come out to the music. That's all I ask. That's what I'm hoping for. The final rumored names for the Hall of Fame, they haven't been announced officially yet, but it sounds like it's going to be Jacqueline going in as the female inductee and Stan Hansen. This is according to the WrestleMania 32 magazine that's already out. I didn't see Regis Philbin's name mentioned anywhere, but he was the rumored celebrity inductee. I'm pretty sure I mentioned his name a couple of months back here on the podcast when the initial list of names was floated. We also haven't heard anything about who might be getting the Warrior Award this year. I think it should be the fans for sitting through all those awful 3-hour Raws last year. But, you know, Jackie being in the Hall of Fame, she had a run in WWE, she had a run in WCW. You know, it's fine. You know, she never really did anything of note, but, you know, she's a tough woman. She, like I said, had a presence in both companies at a time when both companies were at their peak. You know, WCW was very popular. She was there. She came over to WWF in the Attitude Era, and they were doing big business. So she was part of that whole machine, kind of like The Godfather, right? The Godfather had runs as different characters, but they're not putting Papa Shango in the Hall of Fame. They're not putting Kama in the Hall of Fame. They're putting The Godfather. And The Godfather got over because everybody got over during the Attitude Era. And so people like that, I think, will benefit going forward for being part of that era. And Jacqueline may be, you know, that may be rubbing off on her a little bit here too. But also, they just need women. And so you know, it's harder than the men. They don't have as many to put in. I thought they'd put Sable in this year, and I think Sable is going to go in at some point. I know she's had her ups and downs with the company before. You've got the Brock connection, so, you know, it's not like they couldn't reach out to her and extend the invitation to come in, but it's just not going to happen this year. So instead, they're putting Jackie in. As far as Stan Hansen is concerned, you know, he was a big name in the business, no doubt about it. He has every right to be in this Hall of Fame, no question about it. You know, famous match with Bruno Sammartino back in the 70s where he dropped him by accident on a body slam and broke his neck. He was a big, big star in Japan. I mean, he was in WWE for a while. He was in the NWA, and then he left. He went over to Japan, I think it was in the late 80s, and pretty much stayed there ever since. I think it was all Japan. He had a run there and had a lot of classic matches. He had wars. I think war is the better word, with Vader. And there's that one famous match. You can find it online. They're just beating the shit out of each other, and Vader's eye pops out of the socket. He's got to put his eye back in. I mean, these guys fucked each other up. I mean, this was a fucking battle between them, and I think they had multiple matches. So, you know, the wars with Vader. You know, one thing people don't, some people may not remember, is his role in No Holds Barred, which, you know, believe me, not a movie that's going to win any awards, unless it's like a Razzie or something, but Hulk Hogan got him a role in that movie. I don't know how friendly the two of them were. I think they worked together a little bit in Japan. He must have been a friend of Hogan's, but Hogan got him a role in No Holds Barred. He was that guy. He was the brother of the waitress in the bar, and he was just this disgusting, slob-looking guy in the movie. And Zeus kills him and rips a chunk of his hair out of his head. That was Stan Hansen. Don't know that he'll mention that in his Hall of Fame speech, or I should say that they will mention it, because they usually write these speeches for some of these guys. But I don't think that'll be mentioned. So the WrestleMania card, after Raw last week, and I guess Roadblock this weekend, the WrestleMania card appears to finally have taken shape for the most part. We have the main event set now, Roman Reigns against Triple H. We've got Brock Lesnar and Dean Ambrose in a street fight. We've got The Undertaker and Shane McMahon, Hell in a Cell, for control of the company. Charlotte, Sasha, and Becky, which I believe is the first WrestleMania for all three, wrestling for the Divas Championship. We're either going to get Chris Jericho against AJ Styles in a singles match, or some sort of amalgamation of an Intercontinental title match that probably incorporates them with Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Neville, The Miz, maybe Dolph Ziggler. I really hope not. I really just do Jericho against Styles one-on-one. Do Zayn against Owens. If you want to put Neville in there, fine. You know, if they're going to have an Andre Battle Royal, they need bodies for that. So when it comes to guys like Ziggler and Miz and even the Wyatts, I mean, I would imagine you want to keep those guys in the Battle Royal. Otherwise, you know, who are you going to put in the Battle Royal other than the Social Outcasts and Zack Ryder and Jack Swagger? I mean, you got to have some names in there. So probably Kalisto and Ryback looks likely for the U.S. title after this show as well. The Andre Battle Royal, I mentioned. Looks like we may be getting a Team Bree against Team Lana match. There was a graphic that got leaked. I don't know if it was a Photoshop. If it was, it was really well done. But it was Team Bree, and I don't remember who was on either team, because who really cares? Summer Rae was in there. Naomi was in there. But not a singles match between the two of them. It looks like a tag team match of some kind, just to get all the women on the card. And I'm still predicting a four-way for the tag team titles, with New Day defending against the League of Nations, the Usos, and the Dudleys. And I do still think the Dudleys walk out with the belts. They haven't really been featured on Raw much the last couple of weeks. We'll see if that changes this week. They're going to have to start, you know, firming some of these matches up and not just leave it to the imagination. But that does appear to be the full card at this point. And if that is the full card, what do you guys think? Thumbs up? Thumbs down? And keep in mind all the injuries. This is not the card they originally had planned. So given the injuries and some of the matches that got changed, I know not everybody is happy about Roman against Triple H in the main event, but taken altogether as a whole, that card that I just mentioned, if that turns out to be the WrestleMania card, let me know what you think. Thumbs up? Thumbs down? Do you like where this is going? Do you not like where this is going? Is there anything you would change? can send me some feedback and let me know what you guys think.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week gave us the closest thing to an Iron Man match that we have seen in WWE in many years. Sami Zayn and Samoa Joe went about 45 minutes in their 2 out of 3 falls match, which made this a one-match show. It opened with William Regal announcing that Austin Aries will meet Baron Corbin at TakeOver Dallas, and the announcers hyped up a match for later on in the show between American Alpha and the Vaudevillains, which never took place. They also teased a Bayley-Asuka tag team match. That never happened. I like that. I really do. I like that a lot. I thought that was a nice little touch. It gives, you know, it gives it more of a realistic feel. Like, they didn't expect this match to go so long, and so, you know, unfortunately, we can't give you everything that we promised you. I think what they should have probably done is apologize at the very end of the show, right before they went off the air, for not being able to bring us those matches and, you know, hype them up for next week. That would have added another little bit of a touch to it, but I mean, that's a small nitpick. I like that. I like that they did that a lot. The match itself was it was interesting. First of all, the crowd this week sounded comatose, and this was their first show back at Full Sail in like a month. I don't know if this was taped out of order. You know, maybe the show is actually taped second or third. I don't know why it would be. I assume that it wasn't. So why the crowd was so quiet, I have no idea. Even when Regal's music hit at the beginning of the show, when he first came out, and they love Regal at Full Sail, he always gets a big reaction when his music hits. No reaction. No reaction, none. And it carried over into the match with Joe and Zayn. So how much of that is their fault, I don't know. But, you know, the people reacted when they had to. I don't want to say it was like a Japanese match, because it wasn't. But they did react to the big spots, and otherwise, they were just silent for most of the match. They sounded bored. And I have to say, it was very boring for the first half or so. You could tell they were taking their time, you know, and then after a certain amount of time, it finally started to pick up. There was nothing, I wouldn't say there was anything really wrong with the match. They paced it slow because they knew they were going 45 minutes. We didn't know that, but they did. And they knew that nobody was winning a fall for the first half hour. And I did like that, because usually when WWE does these 2 out of 3 falls matches, it's completely pointless, because the first person steals a pin within the first 2 or 3 minutes of the match. And then 3 minutes after that, the other guy gets a fall. And it's like, why even have a 2 out of 3 falls match? It doesn't make any sense. Now, why even do that if that's how you're going to do things? So here, that wasn't the case. They made it feel like a big deal. They showed Michael Hayes at ringside with Hideo Itami. Mauro Ranallo was there. Larry Zbysko was there. I know he lives down in the Florida area. Some guy from Tool was sitting in the front row at ringside. So it felt like a real main event. They tried to make this feel like a big deal. But it was hard to get into the match. I think partly because it was also their third match. You know, we've seen these two a few times already, and so maybe that took the people out of it. I mean, I'm just trying to come up with possible reasons. This is very much, very unlike, I should say, a Full Sail crowd. And for the first taping back, like I said, in a month, it just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me why they were so quiet for the entire show. Like I said, this is not just the Zayn Joe thing. They were quiet for Regal, too. So, I don't know, just very, very bizarre. But, again, it was their third match. And hopefully that's not the case with Jericho and Styles if they have a match at WrestleMania, because that's going to be their third match. But when this was over, I thought it was a good match. It was not a great match or anything like an all-time classic or anything like that. They'll probably make it out to be that, but I wouldn't put it in that category. It wasn't even the best match of the week. It wasn't even the second best match of the week. Joe won the first fall with the Muscle Buster. Zayn won the second fall with the Koji Clutch. Joe finished it off with the Coquina Clutch when Zayn passed out. Referee called for the bell. So it's going to be Samoa Joe in a rematch from TakeOver London with Finn Balor for the NXT title in Dallas. Sami Zayn is wrestling the debuting Nakamura. We'll find out. I guess they'll probably reveal that this week. Which is not a bad consolation prize, seeing as how that's the match that people are really wanting to see. You know, he may not be in a championship match, but I think things worked out pretty well for Sami Zayn. I mean, he's going to be wrestling Nakamura, and you know that that fucking building is going to be insane. I can't wait for that show. And then two nights later, this guy's going to wrestle in his first WrestleMania match for the Intercontinental title in front of 80,000 people, or what I'm sure they'll call 100,000. It's not a bad weekend for Sami Zayn. So I think he'll be okay. But that was NXT. TNA. Got to talk a little bit about TNA here. First of all, Kurt Angle's final TNA match aired on Impact this past week. It was taped a while back, but it aired. He wrestled Bobby Lashley. Lashley won after three spears, right? Kurt's the one on the way out, so you got to put the new... Well, not the new guy, but you got to put the current stars over on your way out, and so that's what Kurt did. And then he turned on Kurt. Lashley turned on him, laid him out, and then EC3, I think, came out to make the save in the end. Unfortunately, Kurt Angle's final match, or the draw of Kurt Angle's final TNA match, did not do much in the ratings. In fact, Impact did its lowest number to date on Pop TV. Just 280,000 total viewers between the 9 p.m. airing and the midnight replay. You know, I keep hearing good things from people about the quality of the matches on Impact, and they turned a corner, and the action is great, and that may all be true. That's all well and good, but they've squandered so much goodwill that it just doesn't seem to be making any difference at all. So you can have, you know, Matt Hardy can be this great heel world champion, and you can have these great matches, and they got the talent. I don't think it's a question of that. They've got Lashley and Angle, or, well, not Angle anymore, but they've got Bobby Roode and Drew Galloway and the Wolves and all those kind of guys. But, you know, when you're branded a certain way, or when you give people... where people give you chance after chance, and you just blow it every single time. After a while, they stop giving you chances, and they always had that core base. Like, WWE has a core base. No matter how bad Raw gets, and we've seen some pretty bad Raws, okay? And the ratings have been going down, but they're always going to have that base of whatever it is, 3 million or 2.5 million, unless they go out of their way. Like, they make it their mission to kill their entire audience. It's not like it's impossible, but they have their base, and they know they have their base, and they're always going to have that base. TNA had their own base. For the longest time, they had a certain number of people. They would not go below that number, no matter how bad the TV was. They can have an Impact that did a 1.0 with over a million viewers on Spike, but then they could go as low as a 0.6 or a 0.7, right? But very rarely did you hear about them going below that. And then they moved, and now they're on Pop TV. And the audience is not as wide as it used to be on Spike, because the network isn't as strong as Spike. It's pretty strong, but I think Spike is a little bit stronger than Pop TV. And that base has slowly been eroding. So all those loyal TNA diehards, there's still a lot of them there, right? I'm sure there's still a lot of TNA mecha people who tune into that show, and they will live and die by that TV show. But their base is eroding. The numbers are going down. They're not going up. And that's not a good sign. Especially now that you have these reports of Dixie Carter having meetings in L.A. and meetings in New York, and they're looking for investors, right? That's what they claim. That's what John Gaborik told PW Insider when they questioned him about that. He didn't deny it. He said, well, we're looking for investors. We want people to invest in TNA. First of all, why anybody would want to invest in TNA, I have no idea. Especially as long as the Dixie Carter is still around. But I think it's more than just looking for investors. I think they're probably looking for buyers, and times are tough, and they know it, and it's just not looking good right now. But I want to talk about Ken Anderson also. Ken Anderson appeared at an ICW show in Scotland last week. I guess the crowd must have been chanting fuck TNA or something to that effect, and he said, I don't work for them anymore, so I agree. Fuck TNA! That's what Ken Anderson said. Yes, fuck the company who employed you for 6 years when WWE fired you and wanted nothing to do with you. Now, believe me, I'm no defender of TNA and some of the stupid shit that they've done over the years. But I hear that and I just think to myself, what an ungrateful asshole. And I could call him that because he used to call himself that, right? Wasn't that his gimmick in TNA? He was an asshole. His fans were assholes. He's living the gimmick. Now, what makes this worse is that, according to Pro Wrestling Sheet, they broke the story. What happened was he didn't leave on his own. It wasn't a case where his contract expired and they just chose not to renew it, and so now he's bitter. He got fired. He got let go for failing a drug test. We don't know for what drug. We don't know what he was on, if he was drinking, if he was taking something. We don't know that. I'm shocked that TNA does any drug testing at all, quite frankly. You got to know that you got to be pretty fucked up if TNA looks at you and goes, you know what? This guy should be drug tested. That's all I could think. So, he apparently failed the drug test. It was given to him. He went out for a match. They suspected that he may have been under the influence of something. They taped a match with him and Eric Young. And I think it was supposed to air on Impact, I think, in mid-January or late January. They taped the match. It was so bad. The match was so god-awful. They cut it from the show, and it never aired on TV. And again, they tested him, he failed, and they fired him. And look, if he's got issues, I hope he gets help. You know, I don't want to see anything bad happen to the guy. I don't want him to turn out to be some tragic story. If he's got an issue, hopefully he'll get help for it. Maybe it was just a one-off. Maybe he was... who knows, okay? Who the hell knows? But obviously it was something pretty bad if TNA said, we got to pull this match from our TV show. We can't even put that. It would be embarrassing for us to air this on TV. And let's drug test the guy. Because I get the impression TNA is not going around like WWE having routine random drug tests for people. Probably only if they see a need for it, they'll do it and they'll pay for it. But this is the same company that allowed Jeff Hardy to go out there for a pay-per-view main event under the influence of God knows what and have a 60-second embarrassment of a match with Sting. To this day, I just don't understand how they allowed him to go out there like that. But at least it looks like maybe they've learned their lesson now. Although, maybe not, because they actually let Anderson go out there and, you know, he still wrestled the match. What's troubling about that is, again, not knowing what the guy was on, I kind of want to see this match now, because if he's out there and he's so obviously out of it, you know, you're putting your opponent in danger here. I'm not like a huge Eric Young fan or anything, but, you know, it would have been pretty shitty for Eric Young to be out there, and let's say Ken Anderson drops him by accident and the guy breaks his neck. Right, I was talking about Stan Hansen earlier. Stan Hansen going into the Hall of Fame this year. Famous match with Bruno Sammartino where he dropped him and Bruno broke his neck. That could have been the case here. How do you let this guy go out there if that's the case? Nobody's back there by the curtain. Nobody's back out there by the gorilla position or whatever they call it there that sees this guy and says, hey, maybe, you know, it's a taped show. It's not like it's live or anything. Why don't you stay back here and we'll, you know, we'll put somebody else out there. So, anyway, I don't know how that even went down, but the fact is, for Ken Anderson to be out there now saying, yeah, fuck TNA, I just think it's so rich. It's so rich to hear him saying that, because this guy, you know, he's articulate, he's done some acting work, he's done some voiceover work, right? Wasn't he on Twitter not too long ago talking about how he was doing a voiceover for some video game or something like that? So, you know, he could be in entertainment in other ways. He could do other things. That's probably what he would be doing right now. Because if it weren't for TNA picking his ass up when they did and putting the championship on him, I mean, he was getting a push for a while. Right? For a while there, he was in a pretty prime position in that company. They gave him a shot when, you know, I don't know that a Ring of Honor would have picked up a Ken Anderson. You know, and again, back when he left WWE... You know, the indies weren't kind of bursting the way they are now. I mean, now it's like you got all these different little promotions out there that are doing pretty well. I don't think it was like that 6 years ago when Anderson got fired from WWE. His options were very limited at the time, and TNA gave him an opportunity. I think he's had twins with his wife. He's got a family to feed, a family to support. You turn around now, because especially now in light of exactly what went down, and you say, fuck TNA. He should be thankful TNA was even around at the time, and that they kept him employed for most of the last 6 years. Let's talk about Lucha Underground. I mentioned last week that you can now buy full seasons or individual episodes of Lucha Underground on iTunes. And now comes word that they may be close to a deal with Netflix to carry at least the first season of the show, which is great news. I hope that happens. The more the merrier. The more you can expand that audience to new people, the better it is for everyone. This week opened with Marty the Moth against the Mac. Sexy Star in his corner. This was just the backdrop for the debut of Marty the Moth's sister, Mariposa, played by cheerleader Melissa, for those of you who are wondering. She's got some creepy theme music, I'll say that. I kind of like it. Sexy Star looked terrified of her when she walked out, and like she was still scarred from whatever they did to her when they had her captive. And Mac was distracted when she walked out to the ring, and he saw Marty's sister. And that was enough for Marty to beat him with a curb stomp off the top rope. So Marty the Moth beats the Mac. Backstage, Jack Evans is draining the lizard when he is attacked by an actual lizard, Drago. Can I ask this question? What is with Drago always popping up in the bathroom in these segments? I feel like we've seen at least two or three other segments like this with him. Like, Dario Cueto would be in the bathroom washing up, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's Drago. It's always the bathroom with this guy. This is a common thing with him. So then PJ Black shows up with a pair of nunchucks, and soon everybody has their own pair of nunchucks. I don't know where they got them from, but now they all have nunchucks. And it's a nunchuck bathroom battle until Aerostar returns from outer space. He shows up in the bathroom. Where else? You know, because when you come back down to Earth, when you come out of the atmosphere and out of the universe and you come back down to Earth, the first place that you want to beam yourself down to is the bathroom. I can't even believe I just recapped all of that, but that's what happened. We then had They Call Him Cage coming out for a no DQ match with Johnny Mundo, except out came Taya Valkyrie in Mundo's place to take the match with Cage, no less, under no DQ rules. Now, even though I am not a fan of the intergender stuff, I've made that very clear, most of the time. On occasion, they've done intergender stuff where maybe it's like a mixed tag or something, and I'm actually okay with that. But these straight one-on-one, like, mismatches here, man, you know, man-on-woman, not a fan. First of all, Cage, as many of you pointed out to me on Twitter, Cage says he's not a man, he's a machine. So, technically, this was not an intergender match. But, even though I'm not a fan of that stuff, I have praised Lucha Underground before for at least making their women look strong. Right? They don't cower, although I guess Sexy Star was cowering, but she was cowering to another woman. Generally speaking, these women, they stand up to the men, they get up in their face, sometimes they beat the crap out of them, they take a beating, they come right back. I mean, they made Taya here look like a badass. She comes out, she's talking crap about the strongest dude on the entire show, and, you know, she took a beating during this match, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there was a hard power bomb, followed immediately by a brutal buckle bomb in the corner. He was throwing this woman around like, you know, I mean, look, she's, what do you think she weighs? I shouldn't guess, because then I would upset some people. But she doesn't weigh that much, you know, she's kind of a tiny woman, and you got Cage in there, who's this fucking man-beast, who's like three normal men combined, and he's throwing her around like she ain't nothing. So she's just getting bounced around like a rubber ball in there, and outside the ring, too, by the way. He gave her a powerbomb into the steel guardrail, like the grate, and then turned around and threw her. He launched her back first into the steel post. And that's the other thing, too, I think, is, you know, it's one thing if you're going to have a woman in there taking a beating like that. So, what I just described to you, right, that would finish off some men. But that was just another spot in the match. It's not even like it was over at that point, or they brought a stretcher out to carry her out. It was just, all right, on to the next spot. She was fine. Cage set up two tables outside the ring. He suplexed her from the inside of the ring, from the top rope, out to the floor, and through both tables. So if the kind of the outside of the ring buckle bomb into the post wasn't enough, now he suplexed her out of the ring through two tables on the outside, you think, okay, well, that's it, right? Of course it wasn't. So, I mean, Johnny Mundo left this woman in there to die. Finally, though, he runs out. He hits Cage in the head with a pipe, which was only good for a two count. He grabbed the cinder block from underneath the ring. He grabbed a couple of beer bottles, which he broke over Cage's head, and had no effect. Although it looked like he did get cut open a little bit on the forehead. Cage went to curb stop Johnny Mundo on the cinder block, but Taya made the save because she's Superwoman. And Cage finally laid her out with Weapon X and got the pin. Well, you know, look, at least he pinned her. At least he got the pin. I was not a fan of this. They definitely made her look strong. She didn't back down. But I just was not a fan of this. We see Ivelisse walking out of Katrina's office, and she tells Son of Havoc and Angelico that next week they get a shot at the Trios titles on one condition. If they don't win, they have to hit the open road because they are gone from Lucha Underground. And this does not please Son of Havoc or Angelico. Well, then maybe they should have grown a set of balls and they should have gone in there and talked to Katrina themselves. How's that for an idea? Ivelisse has bigger balls than both of them. Main event was Mil Muertes defending the Lucha Underground Championship against Prince Puma and Pentagon Jr. And Mil is such a badass. He not only asked for this match last week. Now, normally if you watch Raw or you watch Impact or even Ring of Honor, if you got like a heel world champion and, you know, Nigel McGuinness comes out or William Regal comes out or the Authority or whatever comes out and tells the heel, you're going to defend your championship in a triple threat match or in a fatal four-way match where, you know, in theory, you don't even have to be pinned to lose your title. The heel loses their shit. They can't believe it. Here, Mil Muertes, he asked for this match. He told Katrina flat out last week, I want Puma and I want Pentagon. And I'm going to kill them. I'm going to destroy them both next week. So he asked for this match. And what makes him even more of a badass is he won. He went out there and he did exactly what he said he was going to do, and he beat both of them. He beat two men to retain his championship. That's a boss right there. That's how you book your champion strong. Vampiro's insightful English to Spanish translation of that holy shit chant that you heard at the top of the podcast that I played, that came from a spot here in this match where Puma hit a shooting star press off the barricade outside the ring onto Mil Muertes and Pentagon Jr. Match ended with double flatliners from Mil to both of them to get the win. There was a lot of insanity here that I left out. I'm not here to do move by move transcriptions of this stuff. It was a really good main event. Not the best match I saw all week. I'd say second best. I have to give the edge to the tag title match on Raw. But Phoenix came out after the match. He says next week he is handing in his Gift of the Gods championship for a shot at Mil Muertes and the Lucha Underground title. And that is a match that I am very much looking forward to. If you listen to this show, you know I'm a big fan of the Mil Muertes Phoenix stuff. That Grave Consequences match last year was my match of the year. It was just brutal, insane, fun, awesome. If you have never seen Lucha Underground before and you're on the fence and you're looking for a couple of really great matches to watch, you can buy the individual episodes now on iTunes. Do a Google search. I don't remember what episode number it would have been, but look up Grave Consequences, Mil Muertes and Phoenix, and watch that match. They did the casket match better than any casket match I've ever seen WWE do. If you have mailbag questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. We have a whole batch of them here from you guys that we're going to get to. Please include your name and where you are from, by the way, when you write in. Start with Luis. I read an article that said WWE has sold 84,000 tickets so far for WrestleMania 32. When I went to go read the comments under the article, I saw people debating whether or not WWE inflates its numbers for WrestleMania. I was listening to a video on YouTube a while back with Dave Meltzer explaining that he gets different numbers from the ones that WWE announces. The one I commonly hear is their WrestleMania 3 attendance, and that Meltzer had 78,000 while WWE announced 93,173. How exactly does WWE count the numbers for their WrestleMania attendance? Do they only count the tickets that they've sold, or do they include freebies, employees, etc. in the announced number? And would WWE lie about the attendance for WrestleMania 32 if it is true that they inflate the numbers? Well, WWE lie about something? I mean, I won't hear of such a thing. I know I've talked about this before. I've definitely told the story, the Meltzer, Zane Breslov stuff, because I've been asked about this WrestleMania 3 stuff. And I am one of the people that does not believe in the 93,000 figure to be accurate. I believe the 78,000 figure. So just to give a little bit more of the backstory here. First of all, it is true that Meltzer reported in his newsletter that they have already 84,000 tickets out for this year's show, which would make it legitimately the all-time company attendance record. The previous record, legit record, was 79,000 plus at Wembley Stadium for SummerSlam in 92, which makes it all the more bewildering why they haven't gone back for a major pay-per-view in the UK since. And when I say major, I mean like SummerSlam, Royal Rumble, WrestleMania. It was always about the time zone differential, and now with the network, they really don't have to worry too much about that. So if they don't want to bring WrestleMania there, I kind of get that. And plus, London would have to bid for it, because that's the way the process is now. You've got to bid. So if London wanted WrestleMania bad enough, and they flew over here to make a presentation in Stamford, and they really wowed WWE, guess what? They'd probably get WrestleMania. So I don't know how much of the onus I would put on them, as much as I would also put some of that on London now, because that's just how the process works. But I don't see any reason why you couldn't bring a big show like a SummerSlam back there. They obviously did very well, you know, over 20 years ago when they were there. So it looks like they have indeed set the already set the legitimate attendance record. So to go back to the WrestleMania 3 story, Meltzer, because, you know, if you read some of the older observers, which I've seen over the years, I've seen some of the older issues, and I've seen things that he's written before. And he referenced the 93,000 number that WWE gave out publicly. Now, what happened was, a few years after that, he had a conversation with a man by the name of Zane Breslov. Zane Breslov was a promoter, a local promoter for WWF at the time that WrestleMania 3 took place. He might have been the promoter locally in Michigan. I don't remember. So he would know. He would have had access to those numbers and the number of tickets and all that kind of stuff. So he worked for WWE at that time. He was obviously very good at his job. He was poached away, I think, to WCW, whether he went or they took him, whatever. He ended up working for Eric Bischoff in WCW. I think he might have still been working for WCW when he died. I want to say he died like in the early 2000s. He was in a motorcycle accident, so he's no longer with us. But he definitely worked for both companies. He may have had something to do with the whole concept of the Nitro parties. He seemed like a pretty creative guy. And what happened was Meltzer ended up having a conversation with him many years later on the phone. I don't recall what they were talking about. I'm just going based off my memory of hearing him tell the story before. But it came up in the conversation that, you know, WrestleMania 3 didn't really have 93,000 people. And apparently Meltzer didn't even know that because he was using the fucking 93,000 figure himself for God knows how many years. And I don't remember if Breslov just told him that or if Breslov showed him something, like faxed him over a paper that he may have still had on him. But he saw the numbers. He had the evidence. He would know that the number was actually over 78,000, not 93. They claimed 93, but there weren't 93,000 fans in that building. And so that from that point on is when Meltzer began to say, well, you know, 78,000 is the actual number, not 93, and he was told directly by Zane Breslov, who would have known. Now, some people don't believe it because they just, you know, they have it so ingrained in their brains, this 93,000 figure, and some of them just don't like Meltzer, they don't like the dirt sheets, they don't trust him, they're always wrong, this and that. But again, this was something he was directly told by somebody who helped promote the show at that time. And the other interesting thing also is guys like Meltzer and Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch, I don't know if they still do on occasion. I get the impression that it hasn't been that long, for example, since Meltzer spoke to Vince. But I don't know how frequently they talk. Obviously, WWE has no fondness for the newsletters and that sort of thing. In fact, Vince himself made a comment. He was interviewed by one of the Florida newspapers this past week, and he even said, one of the reasons I don't like the dirt sheets or whatever you call them is because they spoil all of our surprises. So it still sticks in his craw, but he would routinely have telephone conversations with guys like Meltzer back in the day. They could be on the phone for a couple of hours talking about God knows what, and sometimes they would be arguing. Maybe Vince took issue with something that was said in a newsletter. Sometimes the conversations were very cordial. Vince would actually solicit feedback from them. You know, Meltzer was routinely in touch with Eric Bischoff during the Monday Night Wars. Eric was always calling him. And I mean, that used to be how it was. It was a lot more open. And there was a conversation that Meltzer had with Vince, and I don't remember what they were talking about, but he may have asked Vince directly about the WrestleMania 3 number. I don't remember. But the point is that on the subject of the attendances that they announce on TV, Vince's response to the question that was asked of him was, the numbers that we give on TV are part of the entertainment. That's what Vince said to him. So he didn't deny it. He didn't, you know, outright say, that's not true. The number was 93,000. He said, the numbers that we give out on TV are part of the entertainment. And that's absolutely true. And they don't just do it for WrestleMania. You know, last year I was at the NXT TakeOver show in Brooklyn. They had SummerSlam there as well. They're going to do it again this summer. And I'd have to go back and get the exact number. But I know for a fact the number they announced was higher than the number of people in the building. Or it might have even been higher than the number of people that would have even been possible. Because even if the building was full, which it was, just the way things were set up, it wasn't set up. Let's say they announced 15,000, which I think they may have. It wasn't set up for 15,000. They had a sellout crowd. They had 13,000 maybe in change, but they always have to mark it up. It's like they can't help themselves, and they always have to announce a number higher than it actually is. Look, they'll have Raw taping sometimes where they'll say, it's a packed house, we have a capacity crowd, a sold-out crowd, but they're not really sold out. It's part of the entertainment. That's what they say. Now, with WrestleMania, the general rule, certainly in the last few years since they started doing the stadium shows every year, is that they mark up the actual attendance by anywhere from 10 to 15,000. So if you have a legitimate crowd, and I don't know that it's paid. It could just be the number of actual people, or at least fans, in the building. Let's say the legitimate number is 74,000. They'll announce a crowd of 80,000, or they'll say 83,000. You know, maybe sometimes they only mark it up by 5,000 or 6,000, but they always mark up the attendance. So, by and large, when it comes to WrestleMania, the numbers that you're hearing on TV are not the real numbers. Sometimes they're more exaggerated than you would think. Now, for WrestleMania this year, I'm almost positive they're going to announce a number of over 100,000 because they've been teasing it. They had Vince on Raw a few weeks ago. He was in like a backstage segment on the phone with somebody. And he was like, yeah, we're going to break the 93,000. So they've already planted the seed in people's minds that they're going to break 93,000 no matter what. Look, 84,000, if that's their legit highest attendance, that's pretty fucking great. But I guarantee you, they ain't announcing 84,000 for WrestleMania. They're definitely breaking that WrestleMania 3 number, and I think they're going to crack six figures. They'll probably end up doing like 101 or 102 or something. I think that to say 100,000 on the dot would be a little too transparent. But whatever number they announce is not going to be the legitimate number. I have no doubt about that. They'll announce a new fake number so they can beat their old fake number. That's how this game works. And WWE is not the only one that does this. I'm sure other promoters, whether it's for concerts, sports leagues, I mean, some people announce the legitimate attendance and some don't. And WWE is one of those who don't. You know, sometimes they'll announce a higher number let's say they're going to be in a certain stadium. They sometimes like to run a stadium before the Super Bowl, like the year before. So they'll go out of their way to announce a number that's so much higher than the NFL could do, just so they know the NFL can't top this number. Like, that's some of the stuff that goes on. Now, to go back to your actual questions, you know, you're asking how exactly does WWE count the numbers for their WrestleMania attendance. My impression is, you know, the number that they announce or, you know, the number they put out there, that does include freebies. It's the number of fans in the building. I don't know if that counts employees. I don't know if that counts the concession people, like if it's just every body, like physical body in the building or just fans. But at the very least, you know, it's not just paid. It's paid. It's free comp, whatever you want to call it. It incorporates all of that. So that's how it works. You can believe whatever you want to believe. You can think all of this is nonsense and take them at face value, but it's not a real number. Vineet from Mumbai, India. Recently in an interview, Eric Bischoff said that Sting was originally supposed to go over clean in this match with Hogan, his match rather, at Starrcade 97. And it was Bischoff himself who changed his mind and not Hulk Hogan refusing to job. Eric mentions that he did this because he felt Sting was in no physical shape and probably got rusty due to not wrestling regularly for some time. Do you think this is true, or is Hogan refusing to job responsible for what happened? Also, in the same interview, he mentions himself and Brian Pillman wanting to develop the loose cannon gimmick by him going off for some time and then coming back. Is this true, or did Brian Pillman trick him into a release, seeing potential in the gimmick and negotiating the best deal from all three promotions before going to WWE? Well, let's start with the Starrcade stuff first. Bischoff was there. He was running the company. I wasn't. If he wants to take credit for how things went down with that main event at Starrcade, more power to him. I think he's full of shit. My opinion, which is all this is, okay? As far as Hogan not wanting to lose, he lost. He did lose in the end. If he didn't want to do a job, he wouldn't have done a job, right? He had creative control. But he did, in the end, he did the job. It's not about him winning or losing. It's about how he lost. That was always the issue. He took 85% of that match and then basically beat Sting clean in the middle with a leg drop. After building this thing up for like a year and a half, and all the angles they shot, and Sting coming down from the rafters and being the top babyface in the company, and the NWO reigning supreme for all this time, at some point, they've got to get their comeuppance. And the whole thing was, Sting will be the savior of WCW, he'll finally beat Hogan, we'll get the belt back, and then you can continue the angle from there. It's not like the NWO was going to die and go away. But Hogan took the majority of the match and beat the guy clean in the middle. And you can't tell me. Now, look, did he tell the referee not to fast count? I think he probably did. I think he probably did tell the referee, hey, don't fast count. I don't know that we'll ever know for sure. It's always been speculated. It's always been the thought that Hogan had something to do with that. And really, if you're listening to this right now, would you be shocked to find out that Hogan had something to do with it? Probably not. You know, and he made Sting look like a chump. Sting didn't look out of shape to me. I mean, it doesn't mean he wasn't. Maybe he was. I mean, I think he may have had a few house show matches, but by and large, he had not wrestled for many, many months. Maybe he did show up and he was out of shape. Who's to say? But it's not like Bischoff took one look at him and said, you look like shit, let's put Hogan over and keep the belt on him. That's not what happened. Sting still won the match. So we're supposed to believe that Sting was out of shape, and Bischoff decided, hey, I have an idea. Let's have Hulk Hogan make this guy look like a jabron, and make Bret Hart, by the way, who we just paid a gazillion dollars to come over here, let's make him look foolish for attacking the referee for a fast count that wasn't fast. And in the end, we'll put the belt on Sting anyway. That makes no sense. And Sting got the belt back. You know, they stripped him of it the night after. He got the belt back 2 months later anyway. So I guess by Bischoff's logic, in those 2 months that passed between the two matches, Sting must have gotten into Hogan's stash of Hulk Hogan vitamins and gotten himself into peak physical condition. I mean, give me a break. Now, on the Pillman stuff, the idea was they wanted to trick everybody. They wanted to trick the wrestlers. They wanted to trick the fans into thinking that Pillman really did go nutsy cuckoo and that he was fired for it. And they even faxed him a completely legitimate termination letter that was drawn up by their attorneys and everything. They wanted this thing to look legit. And Pillman did go to ECW for a while. I think that was always part of the plan because, you know, Eric didn't care if he went to ECW. ECW was third, right? The competition was between WWE and WCW. They could send Pillman over to ECW to do some stuff and then bring him back. But then he got a great offer from WWE, and he took it. And he could take it because he had already in his possession a legal letter of termination from WCW. It's just unbelievable. So Bischoff got played on that one. I don't know if that was Pillman's plan all along to kind of put the screws to WCW and get the hell out of there. I don't think it was. I just think they were working this thing and Bischoff was working with him on it and they were really excited about it. And Pillman was great in the role and very convincing, but he just got a really great offer and he decided to take it. And WCW ended up looking really stupid because of it. This comes from Nick. I was watching Lucha Underground this week, and with recent speculation that WWE is interested in signing a top Lucha Underground star, I instantly assumed it was Cage. I believe he was in OVW for a while. He fits Vince McMahon's vision of what a star should look like. I look at Cage and think he's basically Ryback with charisma and a bit more in-ring talent. Do you think Cage is the guy that WWE is interested in? Well, I heard that same report. I haven't heard any names floated. I guess it's keeping or being kept hush-hush for now. It's an ongoing thing. I don't know if the guy can get out of his contract or what the situation is, but I read the same thing you did, that it's a top name in Lucha Underground, the top name in AAA. Cage would fit the bill. He would fit the bill. In Lucha Underground, now supposedly it's also somebody who's very unhappy with the creative and wants to leave. Well, I mean, you look at what they have Cage doing. He's not doing much. I mean, he was wrestling a woman on TV this past week. At least he won. That's the good thing. Not everybody wins against the women in Lucha Underground. But they don't really have him doing much. I look at him and I say to myself, it's probably Vince McMahon's wet dream. Could the guy pass a drug test in WWE? I don't have an idea. I have my doubts. But I think I tend to agree. Cage is the name that I think of. Because, you know, Puma, I think they pretty much have Ricochet locked in. And I don't get the impression that he's unhappy. He's in the mix. He's in the main events. He seems to really like being part of Lucha Underground. You know, I think a Johnny Mundo maybe is a possibility. But again, I don't think Mundo is dying to leave Lucha Underground just to go back to WWE. I think we will see him back there one day. And he's dropped little teases about wrestling Seth Rollins and stuff like that. So, I guess it could be him, possibly. But I don't know that he's not really a big star in AAA, is he? I think of the Mexican performers. I think of Phoenix and Pentagon Jr. And I'm torn on that one because I'm the biggest Pentagon Jr. fan you'll find. But he's a perfect fit for Lucha Underground. I would not trust WWE with him at all. NXT maybe, but I think Pentagon is just fine where he is. Mil Muertes is another one. He's also a big name for AAA and Lucha Underground. I don't know that it's any of those guys, though. I kind of come back to Cage like you do. And we'll see what happens. We'll see if he's able to get out of his contract. And if it's not him, if it's somebody else, then WWE might be picking up somebody big soon. Tay from D.C. Do you think WWE missed an opportunity to put the title on Bobby Lashley at the Great American Bash in 2007? And also, if it had been booked properly, could WWE's version of ECW have been what NXT is today? We saw the rise of young talent on that show, as well as a mix of vets, kind of like what we have today. Lashley was still pretty green back in 2007. It was Lashley against Cena, I think, right, in that match? That probably would have been as good a time as any to put the title on him. And maybe it would have helped take people's minds off what had just happened. That was the first pay-per-view since the Benoit stuff became a big story. That was in June of 07. This pay-per-view was in July. Then again, people's minds were still, you know, more on that. Maybe they didn't want to put the title on Lashley because they felt it would kind of fall under the radar. Maybe they wanted all this other stuff to blow over first, and their big plan down the road was to put the belt on him. I don't have any doubt that he would have been their first. And again, it's debatable. He's not really their first black world champion. Some people will say that. But I think he would have ended up with the title eventually anyway, had he not left. Yeah, that probably was the time to do it, looking back on it now. You know, he was in a high-profile match at WrestleMania that year. He was handpicked to be part of that Battle of the Billionaires, get the rub from Donald Trump. And they didn't really do much with him after that. He feuded with Vince McMahon. I mean, again, if you look at what happened here, from the Battle of the Billionaires at WrestleMania, which up until recent years had been the biggest match, the biggest attraction, biggest box office in WrestleMania history, and believe me, Trump had more to do with that than Bobby Lashley did. And from there, he transitioned into an ECW title feud with the fucking owner. I mean, Vince McMahon, you know, bald head and all, was feuding with Bobby Lashley, and I don't think Vince would have put himself out there to feud with somebody unless he had big plans for them. So they clearly had big plans for Lashley. Probably should have put the belt on him at Great American Bash, and just, you know, see what happens. But they didn't do it. So as far as the ECW NXT comparison, could their version of ECW have worked, or could it have been what NXT is today? I think that's kind of what Paul Heyman's vision for it was. That was when Heyman thought he was going to actually have some power over it. He was very excited. He gave some interviews at the time about how he was going to be looking at talent from all over the world. He wanted scour the world for international talent, for luchadors, for Japanese guys to come on in. I mean, he was really pumped up about it until he realized that he didn't have as much power as he thought. And Vince, you know, put his grubby paws on it and fucked the whole goddamn thing up. And we all know December to Dismember, we all know about that, and the big blow-up between them, and Heyman said, the hell with this, I'm out of here. And shortly after that, he was gone. But I think that probably is what Heyman's vision for it was. You have a mix of vets, whether it's Kurt Angle, or Kurt may have been gone by that point, but you take some of those veteran guys, you mix them in with the newer guys, you take a guy like a Kurt Angle or a Big Show, and you have them work with and put over guys like CM Punk, which is what Paul wanted to do. I mean, that's what he wanted to do. At the December to Dismember show in that Elimination Chamber match, he said he wanted Big Show to lose in the beginning of the match. Big Show was the ECW champion. He was this giant, and his plan was to have CM Punk choke him out, I think, in the Anaconda Vice, and Big Show would have been the first person out of that match, and it would have put Punk on the map, and Punk would have gone on to win the match, because he was over. He was the guy people wanted to see. He was the guy that people wanted to cheer for. I mean, Bobby Lashley won that match. You had people in the front row turning their backs on him. I mean, you can draw some similarities between that and the situation now with Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose, and Vince is just, he's got this fucking hard-on for Roman Reigns. And I can understand why. You know, he looks the part. And I don't fault Roman at all. I actually think Roman doesn't get as much credit as he should. He's you know, in this position when John Cena was first getting pushed, Cena had way more charisma. But Roman Reigns, I think, in the ring is a better wrestler than John Cena was at that point when he was really first getting that big push those first couple of years as the world champion. I don't see anything wrong with Roman's work or anything like that. But they're clearly shoving him down people's throats. They don't want him. There's a lot of people that don't want him. Some people do. He's got a lot of casual fans out there. Kids, women, right? Does this sound familiar, by the way? I count myself as a Roman Reigns fan, but I think there's enough of a groundswell against this guy, and there's enough excitement for somebody like a Dean Ambrose, where you could argue that it would be the right move to turn Roman and put Dean in that spot instead. And let Roman grow a little bit more to the point where people want him in that role. That's what happened with Batista. They wanted him in that role. All he did was stand in the background, and he was the big, muscled up, you know, he was the heavy in Evolution. And then they dropped little hints here and there, and he would make little sarcastic comments, and it built and it built and it built, and people wanted badly for him to give the thumbs down and to beat the fuck out of Triple H, and he did, and they did over a million buys at WrestleMania. And you didn't find people booing Batista when he won the championship. This big muscled-up guy, I mean, can you imagine if they tried to push him now with the audience? You know, he's not doing flips and dives all over the place. I don't know. Maybe they would boo Batista today if they tried the same thing over again. But I think people, you know, waited for so long, and the story they told was so good that people bought into it. And Batista became a big star, and he was carrying the SmackDown brand as its world champion. But now you have this situation where you've got Roman Reigns, you've got this guy, like Bobby Lashley at the time, that Vince looks at and says, this is my guy. I want to build around this guy. He's big, he's strong, he looks the part. You know, you'll turn your head in the airport when you see him. He's great. I want him. And he's not the right guy at that time. He's not the right guy at that moment. Bobby Lashley was not the right guy at that moment. They could have made CM Punk. That's the guy that people were cheering for, not Bobby Lashley. And so here we are today. Some things never change. It's kind of a similar situation, I think, again now, where Vince has his guy, and he doesn't give a fuck what the fans want. Because they're smart fans, right? It's only a vocal minority of the audience, even though, as I've said before, I think it's more than just a vocal minority. It's not everybody. I'm not trying to make it sound like everybody hates Roman Reigns, and you know the buildings are packed with 1,000 people, and nobody's coming to the shows. I'm not saying that. But it's just not the right time. And I think it's going to hurt him going forward. You know, in a way, it's not fair to him. You could say, well, we changed our plans last year. What do you want us to do, change them again? Yeah, you know what? Maybe that's the right thing to do. I don't know. I mean, you could change plans. It's okay to do that if you've got a better plan. I mean, God knows Vince changes his mind about things all the time, and usually not in a good way. But, you know, if it's for the better, fine. It's good to be able to adapt and change when you recognize that something's not working, or you know what, maybe this will work better 6 months from now, or maybe we should wait another year. Or maybe we should turn the guy. I'm with Jim Ross. Okay, Jim Ross is a much smarter guy than I am. And he said the same thing when I interviewed him a few weeks ago. Okay, go back and listen to the interview. It's not like Jim Ross could have very easily, when I asked him that question about Roman Reigns, and, you know, what do you think is wrong, and do you think they should make a change? That was the question I asked him. He could have very easily said, as somebody who's been in the Catbird seat before, as somebody who's worked behind the scenes with Vince and WWE on things like this before, you've just got to stay the course, you know, because, you know, in the end, the company usually is right, and it's only a vocal minority, and blah, blah, blah. It's not what he said. His opinion, his view is pretty much in lockstep with what I think and what a lot of different people, what a lot of you guys probably think. That Roman Reigns would be better off being a villain. He'd be better off being a heel right now. And Steve Austin said the same thing. Sometimes to be a great babyface first, you got to be a great heel. I think there's a lot of truth in that. So if you're going to shoot down the argument, then I guess you're shooting down Jim Ross and Steve Austin, who, you know a thing or two, I think, about these kinds of things. You know, again, JR talked about a possible double turn. I don't know about a double turn, but I think in terms of somebody turning and Roman being that person, you know what? I think that would be a fantastic idea. But I know I've gotten away from the original question here, but it reminded me, the whole Lashley thing at ECW back in 06, it just reminds me so much of what we're seeing now with Roman Reigns. And we don't know what would have ended up happening with Lashley. In the end, maybe Lashley would have been accepted as this great big star, and he would have gone on to great fame and fortune in WWE, but he left. You know, within 2 years, he was gone, and we'll never know if they pushed him too hard, too fast. Just like we don't know yet how things are going to turn out with Roman Reigns. I hope things work out for the guy. I like the guy. I'm a fan of his. But I could also look at it and say, this ain't his time. This is just not his time. He's not the guy at the moment. Maybe he will be. But Vince has his vision of how things should be, and he's going to see that vision through. So in the end, we'll know whether he's right and we're wrong, or if he doesn't know what the hell he's doing anymore. Aaron from Craighaven, Northern Ireland. I hope I pronounced that right. I was reading about how Tyler Breeze's push, or lack thereof, has created a situation where NXT talents are questioning whether or not they really want to be called up at all. This is exactly what you have been saying for a while now on Sound Off. Do you think this is going to be a major problem for these guys in the near future? Well, this kind of ties in with that whole report. There was a report this week that Vince does not see many, if any, of the NXT guys as being stars. He thinks they're a great traveling third brand, like a fucking circus act, I guess. But in terms of bringing them to the main roster and being in the WrestleMania main event and all that kind of stuff, he doesn't see any of them as stars. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. That was the report going around this week. I do think that there's a difference of opinion on some things, and I've talked about this in recent weeks between Vince and Triple H. I don't have any doubt about that. And Tyler Breeze is a great example. Here's a guy who was very well liked in NXT, got himself over as a big star on that brand. I don't know that with that gimmick he was ever going to be wrestling for the WWE Championship, but there's no reason for a guy like Tyler Breeze to be called up to the main roster, get a little bit of a push at first, right? They put Summer Rae with him, and he was having matches. He had a Survivor Series match, I think, with Dolph Ziggler, and it looked like, all right, maybe they're going to do something with him. He'll be at that level, like intercontinental, U.S. level. And they didn't even do that with him. And there's no excuse for taking a guy like that and just using him, you know, as a two-minute enhancement guy on TV, which is all they do with him now. You know, if he's ever in a big, like, multi-man match like he was for the IC title a few weeks ago, of course he's in there to take the fall. If you see him in there, it's not to win. It's so that he could take the pin. But most of the time, if he's even on TV, it's a two-minute squash. Titus O'Neil squashes him. Kalisto beats him. You know, when I saw Kalisto, was it last week or the week before? I saw Kalisto get in there with Tyler Breeze. And they shockingly gave Breeze his full entrance. And I thought to myself, man, you know, if they give these two guys some time, like, yeah, they're not going to give them 20 minutes or anything like that. But if they give them a solid, like, 8 to 10 minutes to go out there and have a really good match and they just let it all hang out, this could be a really fun match. And, of course, they didn't, because I guess 3 hours is not enough. So they gave them about 2.5 minutes. But if I'm those NXT guys and I look at Tyler Breeze, who was a top guy, who was in main events on all those takeover specials, and he was just tearing it up, and a guy who cultivated and came up with this gimmick and worked on it and worked hard for so long, and on that Breaking Bad. Yeah, they wish they had Breaking Bad on that network. On that Breaking Ground show on the network, that first season built to the big announcement at the end that Tyler Breeze had been called up, and everybody gives him an ovation, and they're crying, and it's this emotional thing, and yeah, you know, I bet those guys are crying now, but they're crying for a very different reason. They probably feel so bad for the guy, and they're worried about their own careers. Because now everybody who's a success in NXT has to second-guess themselves and wonder, is this what Vince wants? Is this what he wants? Is this what they're looking for on the main roster? Or am I doomed to have a career like Tyler Breeze had? Kaz and Enzo are going to go to the main roster. Is that going to be their destiny? Are they just going to be an enhancement tag team for the fucking Usos to beat up on? I mean, you know, a guy like Baron Corbin, I think, will be fine because he's tall, so he'll be fine. I think Apollo Crews will probably also be okay. Vince will probably look at him and go, hey, we have Lashley back. This is great. So, I mean, some of those guys are going to be just fine. But, you know, you look at a guy like Sami Zayn. You know, Finn Balor. I would think they've got so much invested in this guy, and he's got the elaborate entrance and everything, but who knows? Vince may take one look at him and go, he talks funny and he's small. He's a great hand, but he's not a star, which I disagree with, by the way. But these guys have to wonder now to themselves, do I even want to leave here? It's this weird catch-22 they find themselves in because they want to make more money. They want to be at WrestleMania in front of 80,000 people, but not if they're going to get treated like that. They look like they're having the time of their lives at NXT. They look like they're out there, they're having fun, they love what they're doing, they love the passion of the crowds, and they could wrestle in front of a small crowd of 1,000 people, or they could pack the fucking Barclay Center in Brooklyn, 14,000. You know, why would you want to give that up? That's why I think. I mean, if those guys were able to make the same kind of money that the main roster guys pull, if they could make that in NXT, I don't think any of them would want to leave. How could any of them look at how some of these guys have been treated? And some of them have done okay for themselves. I mean, Kevin Owens done pretty good for himself. There are exceptions. It's not like they're all buried. And I don't throw that word around very often, but I'll use it here because I dare anybody to tell me differently that Tyler Breeze has not been buried since he's been brought up to the main roster, because he has been. And so, yeah, if I'm these guys on the NXT roster, I'm very worried. I don't know that getting that call up is such a, you know, a celebratory thing anymore. And I just don't understand it. I just don't. I see some guys on that NXT roster who absolutely can be stars. And when I hear something like that, when I hear a report that Vince doesn't look at NXT, any of the talent as being stars, maybe it's a false report. I almost think it has to be, or I hope it is, because here's one name that, you know, didn't get mentioned. I think of Bayley. And Bayley, some people just don't get it. They don't like her. They don't get the gimmick. But I look at Bayley and I say to myself, she's a fucking gold mine. This girl is a fucking gold mine. And you're going to tell me you look at NXT and you don't see anybody who can make you money? You don't see anybody who can be a big star? Really? Did you just, like, overlook her? Because I look at her and I see fucking dollar signs in my eyeballs. So don't tell me that there's nobody on the NXT roster who could be a big star. There are some people who will try to make that argument. They're full of shit. Now, I'm not saying Austin Aries is going to get to the main roster and Samoa Joe, and man, these guys are going to, they're going to be big-time players. They're going to make this company so much money. Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe they missed that mark. Maybe they're too small. But don't tell me when you see somebody like a Bayley or you see Jason Jordan and Chad Gable, don't tell me that NXT doesn't have people that can't get over and can't be big stars and can't make money and can't be doing Good Morning America and media shots and fit in just fine. They need new stars. Okay, Chris Jericho's not going to be around forever. The Undertaker's not going to be around much longer. Triple H, okay? You've got to have those new guys ready to go. You've got a lot of talent stockpiled down there. Nakamura will be there soon. Don't fuck these guys up. Take advantage of them. Push them. Make them feel special. They're your guys. You're not doing some talent exchange and using PWG guys and you just want to, you know, you don't want them to get over. They're your guys. They've been down there in some cases for years. They've been working hard. A lot of them are over. They're very over right now. So hopefully they can do right by these guys when they come up. But I think it goes back to the whole Vince Triple H thing. I think if it were Triple H, this wouldn't be an issue. Triple H knows how talented some of these guys are. I can't see him being the one to bring them up and then, you know, bury them 6 feet under. It's just this different vision that Vince has from Triple H, and I don't know that you can do anything about that until Vince goes away or he steps aside or, you know, transitions his power to his son-in-law, which, frankly, I just don't think is going to happen until Vince is just, you know, he decides I've had enough and he goes away. Because he's 70 years old and he's so set in his ways. And at this point, I don't think you could change somebody like that. He is the way he is. And I just hope for their sake that those NXT guys, they all end up doing very well for themselves and having a nice career, because it would be a real shame to have something happen to them like what's happened so far to Tyler Breeze, and just have all of the progress they've made and the success and everything just get flushed down the toilet because one guy is so close-minded that he just can't see things for how they are. Dick from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. On the heels of Hulk Hogan talking about his penis in court, that's funny, getting a penis question from Dick, and all the other slimy things that he's done, be it rubbing lotion on his daughter's ass, using racial slurs, blaming the passenger riding with his son in the infamous car crash for the accident, and many other things. How badly damaged is his legacy and your childhood view of Hulk Hogan? How do you think wrestling fans and the general public will remember him? I don't think the general public is going to remember him very well, because the general public who doesn't care or know much about wrestling is going to know him more now for all this other shit that he's been involved in. You know, the divorce and, like you said, the accident with his son, and now this gawker bullshit. And it just makes him look so bad. It just makes him look terrible. But I think to wrestling fans, if you are not a Hulk Hogan fan, then this just adds fuel to the fire. I mean, you just hate the guy's guts already. You're not going to remember him very fondly. If you grew up on Hulk Hogan, like I did, like a lot of people did, and I was a Hulk Hogan fan when I was a kid, you know, very young, when he's gone, I think people are going to remember him. Those people are going to remember him as he used to be, the Hulk Hogan character, the Hulk Hogan they grew up on. I think his legacy in wrestling will be just fine. Because also, WWE has a tendency, when guys are gone, when they pass away and they're gone, look at the Ultimate Warrior, okay? Look at all the things that they said about the Ultimate Warrior. Look at all the things that a lot of the guys who worked with him said about the Ultimate Warrior. And I remember when he died, they had this network special, and they had Ted DiBiase on the panel. And Ted DiBiase is one of those guys that had practically nothing positive to say about the Ultimate Warrior. But all of a sudden, he was praising the Ultimate Warrior. It made me want to vomit. It's like, dude, we know how you feel about the guy. You could have just kindly said, you know what, I don't want to really participate in this, and had somebody else do it. It's like, ugh. So everybody comes out and now talks about what a wonderful guy he was and this and that. And he's like this fucking god. They literally built a statue now for him that sits in Titan Tower when you walk in. But again, think of all the awful, horrible shit that he said about people and groups of people. And then, you know, all the stories about him being a dick behind the scenes and then not wanting to job and doing this and doing that and only looking out for himself and looking out for a payday. I mean, people love to rake Hulk Hogan over the coals for that. You can't do that with Hogan and not do that for the Warrior. But because Warrior died, all of a sudden, he's this positive person. And I think the same thing is going to happen with Hulk Hogan. The same thing happens with a lot of these guys. When they're gone, you basically deify them. And WWE is going to put these wonderful video packages together, and they're going to make him out to be this saint. They're not going to acknowledge any of this other stuff, obviously. But they're going to, you know, make sure, they're going to highlight the positive and make sure that's how people remember him. And then as years go on, you know, and newer fans and younger fans get older, that's how they're going to remember Hulk Hogan. So I think long term, I mean, his legacy is going to be, it is what it is. It's going to be a positive legacy in wrestling. And I think to the general public who really doesn't know any better and doesn't give a shit about the wrestling stuff, they're going to look at him and they're going to, you know, they're going to think, what a pathetic guy. I mean, that's what people are going to think. Me personally, you know, it's going to be, I don't even want to think about it, but I mean, it's going to be sad. It's going to be very sad when that happens. I don't know if I'd be a wrestling fan now if it wasn't for Hogan. I mean, I might be. That's kind of, you know, what got me hooked. But you could say that about a lot of people. Who knows? All those new fans that started watching with the whole Hulkamania boom. You know, I liked Macho Man, I liked a lot of different guys, but Hogan was kind of the one that hooked me as a kid. I don't know. I don't know if I'd be watching or doing this podcast right now. So I think I'll look back, you know, fondly on the guy for that. But I'm not going to ignore all the dumb shit that he said or the dumb shit that he's gotten himself into. You can't just ignore that. But again, when these guys go away, when they die, WWE and people in general have a way of deifying them. They don't talk about the negative, right? You can say that about celebrities in general. It's not just a wrestling thing. It's a celebrity thing. Celebrities do bad things. They get accused of things, and then they die, and all of a sudden, oh, they're wonderful people. And, you know, you think of... I was gonna name somebody, but I don't want to ruffle any feathers. The point is, I think Hogan's legacy in the end will be just fine. Gel from the UK. One event has been bugging me for nearly 25 years, WrestleMania 8. I've never been able to let go of my belief that the Ultimate Warrior that saved Hulk Hogan was not Jim Hellwig. Every time I see the run-in and the post-match poses, I can only ever see Kerry Von Erich in height, build, and facial features. The refusal by others to accept this has been annoying me for decades. Would you please review this and put me out of my misery? Well, I hate to break it to you, but it was the Ultimate Warrior. There's only ever been one Ultimate Warrior, except for Renegade in WCW, who was very clearly a Warrior knockoff. But no, that was very much the Ultimate Warrior. And I'm actually the opposite. If you go back and you watch that, I mean, his body, he's the amazing shrinking Ultimate Warrior, okay? I'm sure it was his new, you know, gluten-free diet that he must have started on. That's why he lost all that weight. But if you look at his face, if you look at his hands, if you talk about, like, facial features and stuff, he looked exactly the same. I mean, you know, you could just tell. He had, like, these weird, like, long fingers and shit. Like, there's little things like that that I can notice with guys. And it was the same person, believe me. It was always the same person. The infamous one from South Jersey. When Steve Austin feuded with Dude Love in April and May of 98, was this originally supposed to be with Shawn Michaels in a three-match feud for the championship if he had not injured his back in the casket match at the Royal Rumble? I don't think WWE thought that far ahead. I think they knew, you know, like at the Rumble, he got hurt. And I think at that point, they knew he was hurt. Didn't take more than a couple of weeks, probably, for them to know it was pretty severe. And I just don't think he was factored into any post-WrestleMania plans at that point. So I don't think they thought that far ahead where they had like a post-WrestleMania 3 match feud mapped out or anything. I just think it happened and they came up with, you know, they settled on Foley as being the next challenger. I don't think it really changed any plans they had set in stone. Jay from Atlanta, do you think WWE will ever start inducting referees into the Hall of Fame? A few that spring to mind are Earl Hebner, Mike Chioda, Tim White, Jack Doan, and Jimmy Corderas. What say you? I've answered this question before. I absolutely think referees should be and will be in the Hall of Fame. I think Earl Hebner deserves to go in, but I think the first one who deserves to go in is Tommy Young. Tommy Young was maybe the most famous of referees in that NWA period there in the 80s. So yeah, guys like Tommy Young and Earl Hebner absolutely deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Jason from Greensboro, at the 1994 Survivor Series, Bob Backlund beat Bret Hart for the title after Helen Hart threw in the towel. Backlund lost it that weekend to Diesel at Madison Square Garden. Why did Vince put the title on Backlund on Wednesday, only to have Diesel win it in 8 seconds a few days later? Because Diesel was going to be their new big babyface hero, and they needed a transitional champion. They didn't want Diesel to beat Bret for the belt, so they had to get the belt off Bret, and that was the quickest and the easiest way to do it. And Backlund was, you know, Backlund wasn't somebody who was being like mega pushed. I mean, he was, I guess, going into the Survivor Series match, but the whole point was we could take a guy like Backlund and beat him in 8 seconds, and it won't matter. He was the definition of a transitional champion. But it was just to get the belt off Bret first and then have Diesel win it off him. That was the only reason they did that. James, what if Vince McMahon decided to troll the fans, came out at the end of Raw, cut a promo that led to him turning all of the lights off in the arena so that it was pitch black and no one could see anything, and they all had to stumble around to make their way up the stairs out of the building, tripping over each other and falling down the stairs? Well, I don't think the arena would like that very much, but there's also this little thing called cell phones, and everybody has a flashlight on them, so I think they would see just fine. And finally here, Andrew in Arkansas. Buy or sell? on which was the better twist, Eric Bischoff being revealed as the leader of the NWO or Vince McMahon revealed as the head of the Ministry of Darkness? I don't think Bischoff was revealed as the leader. I don't remember it happening that way. Like he was in on it the whole time. Maybe they explained it that way. That's not how I remember it. I remember when he hugged Hogan in the ring, and I remember Hogan, I think Piper was in there, and Hogan said something to the effect of, it was something like, this guy works for us now, or something like that. So I don't think it was revealed like, oh, it was this big elaborate plan all along. And like when Eric Bischoff got powerbombed off the stage at the Great American Bash, he was in on it back then. I think it was just, he joined. And it was a big deal. You know, he was doing that before the Mr. McMahon character ever became, you know, a heel authority figure. Bischoff, you know, beat him to it. But I think in terms of the bigger twist, then I got to go with Vince. I'll buy on Vince and I'll sell on Eric. And I was never the biggest fan of the Ministry. I think I've said that before. Ministry Undertaker was probably my least favorite incarnation of the Undertaker. But I think that moment where Vince pulls the hood off, you know, and he's like, it was me, Austin. You know, it's such an iconic moment from that era. And again, like I said, I just think even not as a Ministry fan, it was a much better twist. It was actually a little bit of a letdown, too, at the time, because people were wondering, like, they thought it was going to be a wrestler. And it was like, was it going to be Jake the Snake? Is it going to be, who's it going to be? Maybe it's a WCW guy under the hood. And then when it turned out to be Vince, it was like, he trolled us. That's what he did. It was like one of the early troll jobs. And it was a little disappointing, but it was still a big twist. And you had Jim Ross with the great call on commentary. As he had a lot of those back then. So I think more in terms of the moment, I got to go with Vince. Absolutely. We are counting down the 15 best matches in WCW history, one match per week for 15 straight weeks leading up to the anniversary of the Final Nitro, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks, actually. And last week, we did match number 12 in the countdown, which was Diamond Dallas Page, Raven, and Chris Benoit in a three-way match for the WCW United States Championship. Triple Jeopardy is what they called it. This week, it's match number 13 from the Clash of the Champions. Clash of the Champions 9, New York Knockout. November 15, 1989 at the Houston Fieldhouse in Troy, New York. NWA World Champion Ric Flair against Terry Funk in a non-title I Quit match where the loser must retire. Flair's been in quite a few matches with the retirement stipulation. And actually, the retirement stipulation may have only applied to Flair now that I think about it. I actually don't remember, but this match earned a 5-star rating in the Wrestling Observer, and for good reason. It was awesome. That's why. And it wasn't about titles. You know, it had gotten to the point where Terry Funk, he wanted to take Ric Flair's pride away from him. It wasn't about championships. It was about pride and respect. And they had a match at the Great American Bash. Flair won that match. And so this was the rematch. Funk had been gone for a while. He was off in Hollywood making movies. He was making the Roadhouse movie with Patrick Swayze. They're remaking Roadhouse, by the way, this year with Ronda Rousey as the star. Funk came back. He was a judge for that final match between Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat. I think that was the Wrestle War match. Music City Showdown, I think. I think that's what it was. So Flair won that match, and when it was over, Funk very kindly asked him for a match, you know, for a title shot, and Flair told him he didn't deserve it. He said he was off in Hollywood, making movies and not wrestling, and that's when Funk turned on him. He put Ric Flair out of action by pile-driving him on top of a table. All of that led to this I Quit match here. Jim Ross and Gordon Solie were on the call. Now, I didn't grow up on Gordon Solie. I know there are some people listening to this right now who did. I'm sure you remember him very fondly the way that, you know, I remember Gorilla Monsoon and Jim Ross and that sort of thing. And as painful as it is to think about, there will be younger fans who think that way about Michael Cole 10, 20 years down the road. Believe it or not, it's going to happen. I know it's very, very sad. But there are people who would say that Gordon Solie is the greatest wrestling announcer of all time. Jim Ross himself has called him the greatest wrestling announcer of all time. I disagree, but it's a subjective thing. Solie, he did have a classic line here. He said, two words, five letters. I quit. It's a famous line. And that's what it's all about. You know, Funk comes out with Gary Hart. He had hooked up with Gary Hart's heel stable a few months earlier. Funk gets on the mic before the match. He gives Ric Flair one last chance to quit before he gets hurt. Spoiler alert, he didn't. He didn't take him up on the offer. I know, it's very shocking, isn't it? Funk did go after the neck in the match, though. It took him a while, but he attacked it. He gave Ric Flair a pile driver. Flair refused to submit. Took Ric Flair outside the ring, gave him a pile driver in the aisleway. And still, he would not quit. So back and forth and back and forth we go, and no sooner does Jim Ross mention on commentary the little fact that Ric Flair has yet to go after Terry Funk's knee to soften him up for the figure four, then what happens? Ric Flair goes after the knee to soften him up for the figure four. And when he finally locked it in, Funk just had no choice but to say the words, I quit. And place goes nuts. Gary Hart is fuming mad. Funk, as promised before the match, he shakes Ric Flair's hand. He tells him that he respects him. And this so enrages Gary Hart that he attacks Terry Funk. And Flair then attacks Gary Hart, which brings out two other members of Hart's stable, the Great Muta and some other dude named the Dragon Master. They attack Flair. Gary Hart goes after Funk. Sting runs out. He comes out to make the save. He puts the Dragon Chaser in the Scorpion Deathlock at the same time that Ric Flair locks Muta in the figure four. Out comes Lex Luger. Now, earlier in the night, Ric Flair beat Brian Pillman. He beat him by hitting him right in the head with a steel chair. It was actually a pretty good match. And after that match, Sting ran out to save Pillman. Luger had put him in the rack, and so Sting comes out to save him. Sting was saving more people on this show than a firefighter. And Sting confronts Luger, who he had been friends with, but Luger's had a change in attitude recently, and he slaps him and challenges him to a fight, but Luger backed down. So that happened earlier in the night. So back out comes Luger. He's got a chair in his hand. He hits Sting with it. And the rest of the heels leave Ric Flair and Terry Funk laid out. It's just mass carnage. They all leave together. And on his way out, Luger takes that same chair, and he destroys the trophies that had been presented to Sting and Flair earlier in the night by Bill Apter. Bill Apter, famous photographer, editor. He was editor at the time of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Jim Ross had brought him out earlier in the show so that Apter could announce the winners. They had a fan poll, fan voting, on who was the most popular wrestler in the NWA. And Apter announced that Sting had won the fan vote. Ric Flair had been voted as the wrestler of the decade. And they both got trophies. And in wrestling, you know, there are three things that you can count on. Actually, there's more than three. But these are three of the things that you can count on. Number one, if there's a wedding, somebody is bound to fuck it up. So don't get married on TV. Number two, if there's a cake, it's going in someone's face. That's the only reason it's there. And number three, if there's a trophy involved, it's going to end up in pieces before the night is over. And that's exactly what happened here. As a match, I think this thing holds up. I was into it. It was a lot of fun. It was never boring or anything like that. I mean, there have been I Quit matches since then. I mean, look, it's almost 30 years ago. There have been I Quit matches since then that are more rowdy and go all over the building and more plunder and blood. And this didn't have blood. This didn't have, you know, it was a little crazy, but it wasn't like overly insane or anything like that. But again, it was a very basic story. These two guys had a feud that had been built up for months and months. It was not about the title. It was a total grudge match. Flair had the bum neck, which Funk went after. He tried to exploit it, and the fans knew about it. And, you know, they brought out some tables and they brought out some stuff. But at the end of the day, it was about who is the better man. It's a very basic story. This is not complicated stuff. So, again, not the wildest, craziest brawl. Not the wildest, craziest I Quit match you've ever seen. But for that time, it was a novel thing to see. Even Jim Ross at one point on commentary said, you know, when they were putting the mic to their mouth and asking him, do you quit? And Jim Ross is talking about, man, this is so unique. This is so novel. Now, you had I Quit matches in the 70s. This was not the very first I Quit match. You had the classic one in 85, also with Magnum TA and Tully Blanchard. I think that was for the U.S. title. But it was a rare thing still to see that kind of match on TV. Remember, this did not air on pay-per-view. This aired live on TBS. So it was very unique. The plan was to build Sting to a championship match with Ric Flair early the next year, in 1990. Sting tore his knee, climbing a cage to get at Flair. There was a show, I forgot what show it was. I still have that on VHS somewhere, actually. But Sting is climbing the cage, and he tore his knee. The worst possible time for that to happen. It just completely fucked up all of their plans. And Flair had promised to drop the title to Sting, and he was going to be a man of his word. He was not going to drop that title to Luger, because Luger was the chosen replacement by management. They said, well, Sting's out. We need somebody who can challenge Flair for the championship. And Luger was their handpicked guy, and I guess that means, you know, he went back to being a full babyface. And so even though they wanted Luger to take Sting's place, basically, which he did, but they wanted him to get the belt, Flair said no. He vowed to keep his word. And Luger did not win the championship. And when Sting was ready to come back as promised, Flair had a match with him at the Great American Bash a few months later, and he dropped the belt to him there, as originally planned. So there you go. There's one instance, anyway, of Ric Flair being a man of his word. I'm sure if you talk to some vendors in recent years, Ring of Honor and High Spots and all of them, they might have a different opinion of Flair now. But at the time, he made a promise to Sting, and he was hell-bent on keeping that promise. So this was a great match. We have two more matches left. This countdown is winding down. We only got two more. And at the end, I'll put the full list online once the whole list is done, so that way if you missed any of them, if you want to go back and watch all 15 of them, you can find most of them, if not all of them, on the network. You'll be able to go back and do that. I've had a lot of fun doing this. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. And maybe we'll do more of these down the road in the future. But yeah, two more matches left. Follow me on Twitter at Solomon so you can vote in our Raw poll every Monday night as soon as the show goes off the air, our weekly Raw Insta poll. And this is the part of the show I mentioned at the beginning. I wanted to talk about this Cloverfield movie. So if you have any plans of seeing it, if you don't want to be spoiled by anything at all, this is where you can turn the show off. Thank you guys for tuning in. This has been a long show. It's actually been a lot longer than I had planned for it to be. So hopefully you enjoyed it. And if this is where it ends for you, I'll see you next week. So you can click off now. Okay? Good. No more warnings. Now, Cloverfield. I almost do think that it would be beneficial to some people who go into this movie thinking that it's either a direct sequel to the original or even a loose sequel or loosely based around the original movie. It might be better for them to know that going in so they won't be disappointed, but in the end, probably just better to not read or know anything and just go into it. As a movie, I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I really, really enjoyed it. I said at the beginning of the podcast, John Goodman is just fucking fantastic in this movie. He's always been a good actor. I remember as a kid, you know, watching him on Roseanne, you know, on TV. But you look at some of the movies he's done, and I'm not even just talking about Lebowski. I mean, I haven't seen too many of his movies in recent years, but I know he's been in some films that have gotten some, you know, positive reviews. But he's not the kind of guy that you really hear too much about, like this great actor, John Goodman. But he was just freaking fantastic in this movie. It's his film. I mean, at the end of the day, it's his movie. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I didn't know too much about her before this, but I do now. She's pretty good. But anyway, as far as the film itself, like I said, really good. And I thought up until the last third, up until the last like 10-15 minutes of the movie, if that would have been the movie, I mean, it would have been maybe not perfect, but it would have been great. Would have been excellent, okay? Unfortunately, we then had the final third or so of the movie. So here's the thing. The movie has no direct connection at all to the first Cloverfield film. Okay, the viral marketing does, but at no point did the viral marketing of the first movie really have anything to do with what we saw in the movie. It's the exact same thing here. I was following a little bit of it this time, but I almost didn't want to let myself be duped into it again. I fell into the trap the first time. And I love the first Cloverfield, and I like that movie more than this one. But again, this was a very good movie. But I allowed myself to get sucked into all the viral marketing stuff that when the movie was over, it didn't answer any questions. And there was, like I said, no connection to anything. All the little clues and everything else. There were websites that were set up called Cloverfield Clues. And I was on there every day. And it's the same thing here. This time I didn't read half the stuff that was out there because I kind of assumed that it was going to be the same thing again. And it was. And the viral marketing stuff in a lot of cases is more interesting than what you'll see in the actual films. But none of it is ever really followed up on here. So don't go into it thinking it will be, because you will be disappointed, I guarantee you. Now, in the movie, they mentioned John Goodman's character working with satellites, right? I don't remember exactly what his position or his title was, but something with satellites, and he knows all about satellites. And don't forget, you know, the satellite that fell out of the sky at the end of the first Cloverfield movie. Right at the very end, they're in Coney Island. This is right before the movie goes to black. You see in the background a little satellite or something, an alien or something, falling out of the sky into the ocean. That's there for a reason. So it is possible that there is a very, very, very loose connection that will tie everything up. And maybe in another 8 years, J.J. Abrams will give us an actual sequel or prequel or something that will tie everything together. And if he does that in 8 years, I will apologize, okay? But I think he's full of shit when he keeps talking about, well, you know, we have an idea and we're going to work on it. You know what? If you had an idea, you would have made the fucking movie by now. It's like, just shut up about it already. It's been 8 years and he's still talking. Well, we have an idea and we want to make it. Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. I think he's full of crap. So I mentioned the last third of the movie. What was it about it that I didn't like? So the movie does, basically, if you've seen the trailer, you know they're in this bunker underground, and the majority of the movie does, in fact, take place in the bunker. And toward the very end, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, she escapes. She gets out, and she sees a spaceship off in the distance. Now, I don't want to get into all the details and spoil everything for you, but I mention that because it was something that John Goodman's character kind of alluded to. You almost thought he was like a conspiracy theory nut. He mentioned there was a chemical attack and there's fallout and you can't go out there, you're going to die, and I don't know what caused it. It may have been an invasion. He briefly mentions aliens as a possibility, okay? But it could have also easily been like another country dropping a nuclear bomb, but he does mention that. But you think he's some crackpot, right? I mean, come on, aliens, give me a break. The movie is very realistic. Like, it's not, you watch this movie and it's not sci-fi, it's not anything like that. It's, you come to think that this is just a movie about how fucking crazy John Goodman is. He's just some psycho that he has these people. It's her and there's another guy in the movie, and he's got these people down there with him, and he's convinced them, and maybe he's convinced himself, that there really is something going on. There really was a nuclear attack and there really is fallout, or maybe there really are little aliens out there, and we got to stay down here for at least a couple of years, can't go anywhere. But then there's little things in the movie where they see pictures of like these little girls that went missing, and you know, there's one that he claims is his daughter, but it turns out it's not his daughter. I was a little confused by a lot of this stuff. Maybe somebody who saw the movie, maybe I misunderstood something, they could fill me in here. They never really followed up on any of that. But they made it sound like this guy's a predator, you know, and we got to get the hell out of here. In the end, she gets out, and it turns out he was right, and there's an alien spaceship off in the distance, and in the last 10 minutes of the movie, you know, we see this little dog-like alien on the ground, and it's going after her, and she, you know, the alien spaceship, she's in a car, and it picks the car up, and it's about to, like, suck her in, and then she throws a Molotov cocktail into it and blows it up, and it's like, what the fuck just happened? It's like two completely different movies that they merged into one, and then I realized what they did. So after the trailer initially came out, we learned that, you know, this movie originally had a different name. It was called Valencia, and, you know, the belief was that this movie was made a long time ago, and it was just kind of sitting there, or it was maybe abandoned by another studio, and maybe Abrams picked it up or whatever. But he decided to give it a Cloverfield title, to have Cloverfield somewhere in the title of the movie, because the actors didn't even know the name of the movie. They were so secretive that they didn't even know that didn't know what the movie was going to be called. So I think what happened here is they had this movie that was made. It's this great standalone thriller. Like I said, it's a great movie on its own. And John Goodman is great, and it's great. And they came up with this idea we really want to hype the hell out of this movie. We want this movie to be a success. We want people to get excited about it. So why don't we incorporate it into the so-called Cloverfield universe? We'll give it an ending. Maybe they change the ending. You know, they put aliens in there. And aliens were not originally in the ending. That I don't know. I'm just speculating on that. But I don't think that the movie that we see now is the movie as it was originally made or originally imagined. And I think it feels tacked on. It feels like a completely different movie by the end. By the end of this movie, this woman is like fucking Sarah Connor from The Terminator. You know, she just destroyed this alien aircraft, and she's listening to the radio, and she hears survivors, and she comes to a crossroads where, you know, if you want to join us, come to Houston. And, of course, there's a sign that says, turn left for Houston, or just go straight, and she turns left, and that's how the movie ends. And it's like, I'm just sitting there, like, thinking to myself, what the hell just happened here? It just feels completely tacked on. They took that ending to make people happy, and they just tacked it on, and it's not what the original movie was or what the original movie was intended to be. I think that a better ending for the movie, if that's what they were going to do, would have just been to have her come out of the bunker and realize that maybe it seems like he was full of shit, the air is fine to breathe, I'm not dying, I'm not burning up in the atmosphere, but then look off into the distance and see an alien aircraft or... See, if you wanted to have a Cloverfield tie-in, maybe it's some kind of descendant or something that kind of looks like it could be the Cloverfield monster or an offshoot of the Cloverfield monster, and then you have her make a comment like, you gotta be kidding me, or, you know, or something, and then fade to black. Now, I say that, of course, if they actually did that, I still probably would have been disappointed. It would have been like, that's it? But I almost feel like something like that would have been a better ending, and then you can speculate like, oh my god, like, is there a real Cloverfield tie-in here? And then you're just left to wonder if there is or there isn't. But this was just, I don't know. I mean, it just came out of left field. It's two totally different movies. On the one hand, it's this great thriller. And it's you know, very realistic. And then in the next breath, it's just this like sci-fi horror movie that just comes out of nowhere. And still is not in any way connected to the first film. So... Maybe if it would have been connected to the first film in some way, I could excuse it. But I think that's probably why I'm not enamored with the ending. So now that you know all that going into it, go see the movie. You'll enjoy it. It's good. And see it in IMAX if you can, too. I mean, the IMAX prices are a fucking ripoff. Okay? No movie ticket should cost $20. I'm sorry. But I saw it in, like, the one legitimate, genuine IMAX theater here in New York. Because they have... other theaters that have IMAX, but it's not real IMAX. It's just like a slightly bigger screen. It's like, they have a name for it. It's called LIMAX. This was like true IMAX. I saw it over at Lincoln Center in New York. And it was actually a lot of fun seeing it on like the big screen like that. 3D movies are the ones that I just can't fucking stand. I can't stand having to wear those stupid dumb shit glasses. I can't stand all the movies that have no business being 3D that they make 3D just so they could charge people more money. Fuck you, you greedy bastards. That's the only reason why they do that. But in IMAX, this movie actually looks pretty cool, and you don't have to wear glasses. So that's my Cloverfield review. Still waiting on that direct sequel. I still think he's full of crap. I don't think he's ever going to make one, but there's always hope, right? What's that meme? You're saying there's a chance? There's always a chance, right? Well, we'll see. 2.5 hours of audio. I'm all tapped out this week. I will see you back here next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic St. Patrick's Day. Don't get too blitzed. And we'll see you back here next week. And until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan's WCW contract splattered all over the internet. He got a $2 million signing bonus, 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid, then great. Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts to say no. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burned.
The Solomonster sounds off.
since 2007. The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.